Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the City of Arroyo Grande. This is our City Council meeting, and it is Tuesday, October 14th. Roll call, please.
Member Barnidge.
Here.
Councilmember Brown.
Yes.
Councilmember Costello.
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie.
Here.
And Mayor Ferrara.
Here. Item three is our flag salute. We're very pleased this evening to have Maureen Sharon here from the Arroyo Grande Valley Kiwanis. And she's going to do our flag salute. If you would, please remain standing for our invocation. Rabbi Jared Sharon is here to do that from Temple or Congregation Beth David.
Yes, everyone, please salute our flag. Hands over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic which stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Ladies and gentlemen, before I begin tonight's invocation, I should tell you that it is the role of a chaplain to bring blessings to everyone in this room. If I bless a faction of which you do not approve, hold your fire. I will have a blessing for everyone by the end of this invocation. Lord, bless the City Council, its members and its staff, for all the good they have done for the community of Arroyo Grande, participating often on their own time in virtually every community event we hold and working long hours to meet demanding deadlines. Bless the members of our police and fire departments, upon whom we depend for our security and safety. They too go over and above their duty statements to organize and participate in community events such as Cops for Kids, and in their off-duty hours, coaching Pop Warner football and other youth sports. They help young people to develop physical courage so that many of them will be our police and firemen of the future. Bless all those who are here tonight, who through their hours of volunteer labor do so much good for so many people. And bless those who come here tonight in the spirit of goodwill, that through their actions they may make a tangible...
Grande Valley. And this is a very special year for Kiwanis. Kiwanis International was founded in July... Arroyo Grande Kiwanis was founded in July of 1973. And our mission is to change the world one child and one community at a time. To that end, Kiwanis of Arroyo Grande Valley has made a profound impact on Arroyo Grande by building and maintaining Kiwanis Park in the village, sponsoring and chairing the Harvest Festival Parade each year, contributing cotton candy sales at the Arroyo Grande High School and football games to benefit the band, raising scholarship money for Arroyo Grande and Lopez High School seniors, providing an annual outing to homebound seniors each December, by bringing them to a holiday performance at the Melodrama, actively participating in the Strawberry Festival each year, doing highway cleanup, working with Arroyo Grande Parks on community celebrations, Halloween and Easter, Cops and Kids, Children's Resource Network, Santa Cop gift wrapping, and much more. We are proud that this year's Harvest Festival had grand marshals who were members of our club, and who will remember clearing the ground to create Elm Street Park many years ago. Kiwanis International's focus over the past few years is eliminate. That's to make an end to neonatal tetanus by immunizing women throughout the world, including South Africa and third world countries. For a few cents per shot, no more tetanus-infected babies will be born only to suffer and die. Kiwanis International began in January of 1915 when it was founded in Detroit, Michigan. And this January, we will celebrate Kiwanis' 100th anniversary. By 1924, there were 90,000 members of Kiwanis in more than 1,200 Kiwanis clubs. Kiwanis International is based in Indianapolis, Indiana, where the 2015 International Convention will be held in June for our anniversary. So thank you. We look forward to continuing to support the children of the world, starting right here in our city. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Maureen. Okay, we're going to move on to item 5, which is agenda review. 5A, closed session announcements. We have none. 5B, move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. That takes us to item 6, special presentations. And there is a correction on the agenda. The Economic Vitality Corporation will make a presentation, I understand, at, is it the next meeting, Steve?
Next month, probably.
Next month? Okay. But we do have a presentation by the San Luis Obispo Regional Rideshare. This is Rideshare Month, and we welcome Sarah Sanders here. Sarah, come on up and join us.
Hello, everyone. My name is Sarah Sanders, and I'm the rideshare coordinator at SLO Regional Rideshare. I'm new, so it's kind of fun for me. I'm just introducing Rideshare Month, which is this month, October, and we're doing three main campaigns. The first is Hidden Cash Slow, so hopefully some of you are following us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or even on our website. We are doing $100 drops every day, trying to incentivize smart commuting, and these are all related to smart commutes around the county, from park and ride lots in North County to bus stops in South County. You don't know where we're going to be unless you're following on social media. So I encourage all of you to follow us. If you want a $100 bill, why not? And our next big campaign is these rideshare T-shirts that some of you got today. If you log 5 smart commutes on iRideshare.org, you can get a super commuter T-shirt. And you can get them at either the bike breakfasts, which are the 22nd and the 23rd of this month, or just come and visit us at the rideshare office. And then we have You Scream, We All Scream, we all commute for ice cream, which is an employer-based program where all the employers that are involved in iRideshare will be competing. The company that has the most new accounts on supercommuter.org wins ice cream for the day. So that's kind of going to be fun. Speaking of which, our employer commute coordinator, he's new. His name is Peter Williamson. He's anxious to work with employers in Arroyo Grande to implement flexible rideshare programs.
Perhaps obvious reasons, I understand our police department has made a request for some assistance tonight from the San Luis Obispo County Sheriff's Department to help us with maintaining, good orderly conduct and protocol. And we're very pleased to welcome Sheriff Ian Parkinson here and also Commander Haskell, who's in the back of the room. And so I had to have a chat with them and find out how they want to work. And so there are a few ground rules that I want to go over for public comment. And as you know, in the past, we've had quite a bit of discussion about applause. It seems as though it changes. I know that our policy in the past has been to curtail applause, and I explained, I think, at the last meeting why that is our policy. And it's not just our policy. It's the policy of the Board of Supervisors. It's the policy of several other forums. And the reason why is because when there is a lot of applause after a certain speaker gets up and shares a point of view, someone who may have a differing point of view may be reluctant, intimidated, even fearful of coming up to the podium. And that's what we want to try and avoid. That said, I'm sort of informed here that if the applause is orderly, it really doesn't rise to the level of a disruption. And so I'm going to suggest this, and I understand that it is used at several other meetings. And it would help things a great deal. If someone does get up and make a statement and you agree with it and you wish to demonstrate unity or solidarity, you might just raise your hands and wave, and the cameras will pick it up, It'll be less disruptive. You'll still get your point across. So that's a compromise. I'm asking you to consider it. It's up to you if you choose to accept it. I will enforce the three-minute rule, and I have my my iPhone timer here, and I will give you a few extra seconds to wrap up. But at 3 minutes, I expect that you will demonstrate courtesy and move away from the podium. If we have a situation like we had at the last meeting, then the microphone will be turned down. The sheriff will step forward and ask you to take a seat. So that's the way the three-minute rule is going to work. With regard to other incidents, for those of you who were at our special meeting, you realize that we had a disruption that required me to recess the meeting, and that will occur again tonight if we have a similar disruption, and the person will be escorted from the chambers. It's regretful that we have to spend time going over this kind of protocol, but it seems as though it's necessary. Okay, so with that, we're going to go ahead. I think I've covered all of the main points. We're going to go ahead with community comments and suggestions, and I hope that we all kind of tend towards civility tonight and get through this. So our first speaker, Bob, good evening.
Thank you, members of the council, staff, public. My name is Bob Lund, 1202 Linda Drive, and I'm up here today to speak for Arroyo Grande in Bloom. A week and a half ago, nine of us volunteers journeyed to Philadelphia for the 8th American in Bloom Symposium. Arroyo Grande in Bloom has been participating in this program for 8 years. And once again, we came back with some wonderful awards that I want people to know about. Our wonderful wall in the back here has 7 plaques. We now add the 8th one. We got 5 blooms again this year. And I don't know where the camera is. But we're very proud of this. This is the highest award that American Bloom gives to any community. And this is the third or fourth year, I forget which, that we received this.
And it's for community involvement.
For community involvement, which we're very proud of. We have a lot of that in this community. And one of the other great awards we got was a special award, and it's called the Best Water Management Program. And this is especially wonderful because we beat out 32 other cities to get the Outstanding Achievement Award for Landscaped Areas. To get those two awards together is pretty significant for our city. I also want to add that our esteemed mayor is a member of the Board of Directors of American Bloom. And in 2016, we're very fortunate to be able to host the American Bloom Symposium right here in Arroyo Grande. This will be the first time that the American Bloom Symposium has been given west of the Rockies. I'll get that.
So, funded 100% by Kathy and Nick Tompkins. That's where all the funding comes from. And they will be maintaining that mural over time. The other project is People Self-Help Housing. And that's located on Portland. It's a wonderful project. They'll be dedicating it October 16th at 11 o'clock, so I hope people can show up for that dedication. But what they've done is include in that project a wonderful work of art representing the Japanese-American farming families here in Arroyo Grande. And they were able to incorporate the cost of that piece of art in their project. And we're very grateful to both People Self-Help Housing and to Nick and Kathy Tompkins for stepping up and funding these projects. So I just wanted to let everybody know that. And if you have any questions about public art, let me know.
Do we have an update on the Chumash project?
Oh, we do. We do. For those that are unaware of the Chumash project, we've been working with our local Chumash community and have invited them to provide a proposal for a piece of public art that would represent their contributions to our community. And they have made a proposal of, I think it's a 7-foot, give or take a foot, tree that will be carved in the center It's going to be made of wood that it be preserved for years. The Chumash are providing most of the cost for the Indian artist to do this. We reached out to the Community Foundation, and they've provided us a very healthy grant of, I believe, $5,000. And today, when I made a presentation to the Rotary, Pismo Beach Rotary, about public art, Assemblyman Kachu Ashajian stepped up, and he said that he would provide the remaining funding. So it is fully funded, and we hope to start work on that project very soon. It will be our third public art project.
All right. Very good.
Okay. Any other questions?
Good.
Good evening, Mayor and members of the City Council. I'm Judith Bean. I'm President and CEO of your Chamber of Commerce. And I'm here tonight to encourage residents to take just a few minutes to read the proposed Charter City Initiative that's posted on the city's website before marking that ballot. It won't take long. It's only 5 pages long. It's important for local residents to understand that the proposed charter could be a very good thing for Arroyo Grande. It was drafted by 11 of us from all walks of life and political backgrounds and ages and sizes, and who met over a course of many months at publicly noticed meetings. We poured through reams of data from other cities. We talked to proponents for and proponents against the measure. The only negative we ever heard were concerns from union members who did not want the city to be able to decide whether to pay prevailing wage on just locally funded projects, which you know there aren't many of. Most projects receive state or federal grant money and wouldn't be eligible. But nonetheless, it's a completely non-issue now because SB 7 has been upheld by the courts, so that comes out of our charter initiative. The charter doesn't give the council any more money or power. It's simply a tool for the city to have the ability to manage local finances in a cost-effective manner. The council can't raise fees or taxes, and they can't take action on anything without a full hearing in front of the public. The checks and balances are in place. That's why our committee of 11 people were unanimously in support of becoming a charter city. Please don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. The charter will allow the city to save money. It's as simple as that. Vote yes. Thanks for your time. And I just got to say, I've worked with Steve Adams for 9 years now, and I know how hard you work. And I want to thank you for everything you've done for this city.
Thank you. And thank you with the hands. I appreciate that. Okay, next speaker, please.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. My name is Aaron Hankel, 196 Alpine here in Rio Grande. I was very disheartened recently to read in one of the fringe news organizations somebody on this board had derogatory comments and emails towards constituents of this city in emails. I think you five should hold yourselves to a very high standard when it comes to making comments about your constituents. Remember, they voted you into spot. Any derogatory comment in writing is just foolish. It's going to get out there sometime. Somebody's got it. And for you to have done it, whoever, is just reprehensible. And you should resign immediately. Because this is talking down about your own.
Thanks for the hands.
Vanessa Andrews, Rio Grande. To follow up on what he just said, I actually have that email. And I, too, find it pretty disgusting to read that our citizens are just disregarded. And that's what the problem is, I think, from the very get-go, is that we've been disregarded. You guys are running the show, and for whatever reason, you continue to defend the people that are supposed to be giving you correct direction. I see them leading you down the wrong road. Why you continue to defend them, I don't know. These are all the statements that the officers provided. Also, the letter of no confidence. None of these were printed in the newspaper. None of them. You could refer to them online, but none of them, which is the detailed accounting of what happened on that darn night. Then you have Mr. Adams' recent resignation, I guess. It's whenever he feels it like he wants to. I do not want this guy involved in training anybody in the future after this. He gets a free one-page ad detailing his side of the story. Not to mention, it gets encapsulated in a front page above the fold announcement that he gave his resignation. This is unfair, because these are not correct statements. These are lies. I just want to know what it is that this guy has got on you, or he knows that you keep him employed. He should have been terminated at the get-go. And I'm going to keep coming back every time and demanding that.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Patty Welsh of Rio Grande. I've had an unfortunate situation twice now since campaigning for Jim Hill. I had a window broken out on one vehicle. I had racial slurs written on another one of my vehicles. I want to say hats off to Officer Smith, who came to my home after the first incident, told me where to put cameras on my property, and was very polite, professional, and prompt in his response. I'd also like to give hats off to Zach Ayala, who, when he found the writing on my car, cleaned my car for me. Outstanding service by both those men, and that's why I back the men in blue. They're there for me when I need them. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
I didn't bring props this time, but I did bring a gift. My name's Leanne Akins, and I live at 608 Cornwall Avenue in Arroyo Grande. There's been much discussion of government ethics in the city of Arroyo Grande lately, and tonight is no exception. I went on a search to find the ethics rules that you all should be following, and I couldn't find it anywhere on our website for the city. So I went on a search, because I believe that you all should be following some ethical guidelines. So the internet is a great place. And what I found is the website for the League of California Cities. And then I found a link to another organization that the League is connected to, and that would be the Institute of Local Government. That is where I found the handbook that you all should be following, and in my opinion, are not. So this is what I learned. Ethics laws constitute a minimum standard of your conduct, not the ceiling. Just because something is legal does not mean it is ethical. Your use of the Brown Act, especially regarding closed sessions and other transparency issues, are glaring examples. I also learned by reading this website that ethics are complex. They're not necessarily intuitive, but the problem is if you don't understand them, any misstep can cost you dearly, and it has. It's cost you very dearly. And the even sadder part is I don't think any of you recognize that. The other thing that this website shared is ethics is particularly important in public service. The public's trust and confidence in its leaders and institutions is vital to this.
And I really do appreciate the hands. They're still seeing them. It's still good. Thank you.
Hi, good evening. Susan Flores, 529 East Branch. Mr. Mayor, City Council, staff, I just want to express in this difficult time being a victim of the media, tried in the media, persecuted, found guilty, and I sympathize with the situation here that's taken place. And there are many things that I appreciate about Aurora Grande. There's been a lot of things I've disagreed with that have taken place. There's a lot of things that seem to be in a shortfall at this time. But I still appreciate the job that you do. Sometimes things don't work the way we want them to work. And like I say, being a victim of the public opinion and tried in the media, I sympathize with that aspect of it. I wish all of this to have a good resolve. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Hi. Good evening. My name is Kim Arod. I'm a village resident of 27 years at 534 Allen, and I'm a village merchant for 17 years. And I have it all written out, so I won't go over 2.5 minutes. I'm here tonight to show my confidence, support, and admiration, yes, admiration, for all the city council members and the city's administrative staff, and specifically our city manager, Steve Adams. You know that this does not mean carte blanche endorsement of everything you do. Through the years, I have had encounters, we'll just call them that, with each and every one of you. And so you know that I'm one to speak my mind bluntly and honestly. Tony, do you remember me putting up a 19-foot curtain on Crown Hill Terrace so you could visualize how oversized the Creekside project was? Or Kristen, how I stamped my feet when I protested trying to get permission to plant a tree in front of my business because it blocked my one window. And Steve, do you remember how upset I was and slammed the door of your tiny office in the old city hall just because you would not approve the moving of 3 of the potted trees to East Branch, so it would encourage walk-by traffic? I remember these incidents. I've got them on all of you. I remember these incidents and many more. And every single time I presented an idea, a comment, a complaint, or a compliment, I was treated with respect and true, sincere consideration by any member of the city staff and by every member of the council. I think it's reprehensible that a handful of malcontents, though probably initially well-intentioned, have parlayed the incident of July 3rd into a circus of accusations, hurling personally vindictive remarks to council and to staff in public forums, and think that it's okay. Most of all, other individuals and associations have seized the opportunity to piggyback on this display and sully the Arroyo Grande Council and city staff in the hopes of future political gain. I shudder to think that anyone can disagree with someone and personally insult him or her in public to make life uncomfortable for another resident.
That's the timer.
Okay, wait a minute. We might lose wonderful staff because of misplaced wrath. My mother just passed away from natural causes at the age of 102. I mention this because if I am lucky enough to have inherited your genes, you all might be stuck with me for another 40 years. And that's my point. We all love Arroyo Grande.
Okay.
And want to stay here. Stay, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Hello, all. My name is Michael Passarelli. I live in Grover Beach. I would like everyone, within the sound of my voice, to imagine divided, families are stressed, employees walking on eggshells? We can stop this now. Let the investigation do its thing. Because here's the thing about stopping. When you stop, yeah, it feels so good. You know why? Because the minute you stop banging your head, the healing process begins. So, Roy Grandy, it's time to heal.
Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please.
Chuck Fellows, 33rd of the century, and Roy Grandy. Both Ken May and Michael, a hard act to follow. I'm not an actor or anything like Ken May. I want to start out with a letter from someone who can't be here. Quick paragraph from Ross Congable, who's the president of the Historical Society. I'm pretty sure this doesn't come from the whole society, just from Ross. It says, "I'm sorry I'm missing the meeting. If at all possible, find a way to mention my support tonight." Quote, "I am in complete support of our city council, mayor, city manager, and all city staff, including our honorable police force. Please consider refusing Steve Adams' attempt to placate the few by resigning and retain his expertise in conducting city business for the majority of our citizens. Do not succumb to mob tactics unfounded, unproven accusations. Respectfully, Ross Congable." Now, in the time I have left, I want to let everybody know, and folks at home too, that I am proud to be part of a new citizens group. It's called freeagcouncil.org. Maybe the name will make more sense after I finish. I can promise you this is the rest of what I have to say will be short, but it will be disjointed. We're a brand new group. We're probably 22 hours old right now. We'll soon have a website, freeagcouncil.org, and people can visit the website. I want to start out by saying that one of our members wrote this, and I think it really says it pretty well. "How is it that in a great democracy, 20 or so men and women can submit a no-confidence vote and expect to prevail over the clear majority of people who voted the mayor and council in?" That's the end of his quote. The comments follow are mine. "It's as if the inmates have taken over the asylum. It seems that we all agree, all the people in freeagcouncil.org, and there's about 25 of us now, we agree that our council has been practically hijacked by a vocal group. We need to free AG, the council, to move on and let the council govern. So, our it's not really set in stone yet, but our mission statement follows. Freeag.org mission statement is, save the AG council. We're a group of citizens getting together to publicly voice, our confidence and support of the Roy Grandy City Council, Tim Brown, Joe Costello, Jim Guthrie, Kristen Barnich, and Mayor Tony Ferrara. And our confidence and support in the city administration and staff, Jane and all others.
Time to wrap up, Chuck.
Our effort to specifically show support and confidence in the city manager, you're going to love this, and hope that he will stay as city manager and rescind his resignation.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your comments. Thank you. Thank you for the hands. Next speaker.
Good evening, everybody. I'm Lynn Reardon-Smith, and my background is I'm not a citizen of Roy Grandy. However, I have worked for the city of Roy Grandy for over 10 years and recently retired, and I worked as a planning commission secretary. And so I've worked in the midst of the administrative office. And I saw Steve arrive at the office, start his job. I saw Teresa come into the office and work when she was very pregnant with bronchitis. She dragged herself in always. She was very dedicated to the city. She still is. And so was Steve. Steve always harbored a wonderful, good office where people wanted to be. And there was a lot of laughter in the office. And pretty much felt feeling that he was an open door that you could go to and talk to if you had any problems. And each of the people on the council have worked very hard. They've worked through sometimes the Architectural Review Committee and the Planning Commission and then onto City Council. So they've done their background, they've done the hard work. I just am shocked by what people have been saying. I'm absolutely shocked. And I do hope that this comes to a good end and that these people stay. Particularly, I would say, just scandal, really, just scandal. And somebody somewhere let a story out that was twisted, really twisted, and people have grabbed onto that. And they want a juicy story. People have even asked me, oh, you work for the city, you know these people, what happened? And come on, give us the juice. And there is no juice, and there was no juice, and I told them that. And they're kind of disappointed. They want something. And I'm afraid that when the investigation comes, that people still won't believe it.
Time to wrap up.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, thank you. Next speaker, please.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, City Council members, and city staff. My name is Bill McCann. I live at 575 Crown Hill Street in Arroyo Grande. I am proud to have lived in Arroyo Grande for the past 46 years. When the City Hall event was first released and the Arroyo Grande police made their report available, I was relieved when they stated that they had not witnessed any inappropriate behavior and no laws had been broken. If I had been on the council, I would have acted the same as our council did. The council did what all fair-minded people would do, consider them innocent until proven guilty. I have the utmost respect and admiration for our mayor, city council, Steve Adams, and Teresa McClish. I hope the impartial investigation will exonerate them all, and I hope that Steve Adams will change his mind and continue as our city manager. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments, Bill. Anyone else?
Mayor Ferrara, honorable members of the council, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Rudy Xavier. I live at 347 Rodeo Drive. I am really frustrated to have to reappear here in council chambers yet make another plea for reason and civility. We've all witnessed the conversion of public comment access. Lady, and some of us are alarmed not only at the rising tenor of these comments, but the lack of positive impact incivility has on public discourse. The audacity of the claim shouted against our mayor, who we elected, and city manager, is at best an attempt to intimidate the council and at worst malicious accusation. At issue is the lack of civility and stark lack of fair treatment, particularly in the insidious attacks on the character of Mr. Steve Adams. To extrapolate from the so-called incident that the man is therefore unfit to serve when outrageous charges are made is unbelievable. It's nothing less than a leap of faith that there's been a cover-up in addition. The foundation of this country is rooted in fair treatment for all. Benjamin Franklin said, and I quote, "Justice will never be served when outrageous charges are made unless those who are unaffected are as outraged as those who are affected." Some of us are speaking today as unaffected because we're by a small number of highly shrill voices being heard in this chamber, frankly, because we didn't lose our jobs, like Steve Adams. But that's exactly why we need to speak out. And in conclusion, I am sure you will agree that an informed electorate must distinguish between facts and manufactured facts, which, by the way, are called fiction. Now, if the attraction of fiction is just too much for you, you know, we've got this wonderful library in Arroyo Grande. It's full of fiction. Go there and let the city council, elected by the majority of the people of Arroyo Grande, do their work. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Uh, My name is Minetta Bennett. I have mayor, city councilman, staff. My name is Minetta Bennett. I've lived on Allen Street forever. I am a 1947 graduate of Arroyo Grande High School. My husband was a 1944 graduate of Arroyo Grande High School. Yay, Eagles. My husband was a fourth generation resident of this county. He was 85 when he died. Frank Bennett, in 1911, was the mayor, the new mayor, and constable of the new city of Arroyo Grande. My husband's other ancestors were J.N. Jatta, E.C. Loomis, Muriel Bennett, Ralph Bennett.
I haven't seen a full house here in probably 4 years. And so that's my question. Where is the public when important issues are decided, such as the drought, traffic problems, housing development, and why isn't preserving our ag land as important as the incident of July 3rd? Why aren't those things just as important or more important? Where is the full house? Where is everybody? And I think that sums it up. I'm just kind of disgusted that, you know, everybody can show up for this, but the things that may matter a whole lot more in 50 years to the residents that live here, there's no support or not enough support. So I want to go on a record as supporting Mayor Ferrara and the City Council and Steve Adams and all of his staff. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Honorable Mayor, council members, staff. My name is Mike DeRees. I live 543 Via Bandolero here in Arroyo Grande. I've been here for 25 years, and I'm not a perfect person, but I'm a good person. I think I'm a good person. And I've been involved with the council and with the town for a long time since I moved. I'm very active in the community, and I'm very proud of the way that this council, over the years, has performed. The city staff, I just can't say enough about you guys. And I just hope that this stuff stops because it's just not right. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Hi, everybody. My name is Jan Scott. I live at 202 Fortuna Court in Arroyo Grande. I've been out of town for several weeks. And I have to tell you, I've been having a really hard time wrapping my brain around everything that's been going on. Many of us would have been out of our seats earlier, but we just didn't believe it was going to keep going on or that it was going to keep getting worse and that it was going to turn into this nightmare. But now it's time for a majority to be heard. This council and administration have been among the finest to ever govern in SLO County. And I say that even when I have completely disagreed with a decision of yours. You have years of bright accomplishments, caring for constituents and anticipating the needs of the future. You have kept our city humming while other cities floundered in argument, bickering, and distrust. I am proud of you. I and others here tonight are here to express support for our mayor, our city council, and for city manager Steve Adams and our staff. You have all shown exemplary service over the years. We believe in your dedication to and love for our city. We could not have asked for more or better. I am proud to stand in support of you and your work, and ask others here tonight who feel the same way to please stand and show your support right now. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
Mr. Mayor, City Council, staff, my name is Doug Perrin. I live in San Luis Obispo, and although I do not live in Arroyo Grande, I did work here for 33 years. I'd like to start by thanking the Tribune for taking a few to task last week for the lack of civility. Thank you very much, Cynthia, and your editorial staff. The City Council and staff really deserve respect, and I think a lot of the people spoke before me expressed that very well, more eloquently probably than I will. But the lack of civility, the lack of respect has been shown to the council and staff. It just appalls me. Last week, I was shaking. I was so angry sitting in the chair over here, but I'm calm now. Anyway, I want people to know, you talk about a hostile work environment, and Lynn spoke to this a little bit earlier. That doesn't exist in City Hall. Whoever brought that up, I can't remember who it was, that just doesn't exist in City Hall. People in City Hall love each other. They love the city manager. I want folks to know about your mayor, too. Tony is very dedicated to this city. He's out many Saturdays working with Oregonian and Bloom. He spends his own money to go to the National Symposium that Bob spoke so eloquently about. He's the president of the League of California Cities Executive Board. This is an outstanding man who's well respected in the state of California, not just in the city of Rio Grande. I want to talk a little bit about successes over the last number of years and things that have gone well for the city of Rio Grande, and not just because of.
Cindy Olarcio, Rio Grande. I'd like to follow up to his comment about respect. Respect goes both ways. When a member of the council has the audacity to put in writing basically that they don't have to respect the city constituents, then they don't deserve the respect from the city constituents. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your comments. Next speaker.
My name is Otis Page. I live at 606 Middle Street. There are two prevailing questions in my mind as we consider the issue before you. The first is the fact that the police have indicted the mayor and the city manager. Are we saying tonight the police lied? We don't know the answer to this. We're waiting for the results of their interview. I would suggest to everybody who is loyal to this council, as I am loyal to this council too, hopefully, that you really get the facts on why the police were upset on the issue. Right? The second thing is that we had the meeting on Wednesday at 9 in the morning, where I was misbehaved. And I'm sorry, I apologize to council. I was wrong, okay? But I was wrong because you had already made the decision that you are going to do the interview. In fact, there were points made the day before the 8th. Now, that was very offensive to those people who were with the truth in this matter. Now, on the 9th, I personally went to the council, to the city hall, to see if I could participate in the interviews. I was told I could not participate because it's a political matter. Since day one, when this event occurred on July 3rd, we've had closed sessions on this issue, all under the umbrella that was a personal matter. I'm suggesting to you that was a fraud. It was a political matter. That's why it was a cover-up. Now, for everybody here who's championing you, the council, be advised there is a grand jury complaint. Furthermore, we expect to take the issue of the cover-up by the council in closed session to the Supreme Court if we have to, because we want the truth. Amen.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Thank you for your comments. Next speaker, please. Okay. No, please. Please. I'm sorry. OK. Okay. Next speaker, please.
My name is Wynton Tullis. I live at 534 Island Street in the village of Roy Grandy. Been a citizen of Roy Grandy since 1968. I was with the Roy Grandy Fire Department for 34 years. I was in a management position. Had the opportunity to work with the city council, the administrative departments, and I've been real happy to be here for 34 years. I hope that a few people won't be able to destroy what the city council and the administrative people have been able to do for the city. They've been able to keep it from going under, from being in debt. Thank God for what we've got. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
My name is Colleen Martin. I live at 855 Olive Street. I am so confused. Between July 4th and July 7th, the mayor asked, outside of any formal meeting of the council, the city attorney, for an informal investigation of the city manager. In the July 8th closed session, the report from Mr. McMahon was reviewed under the performance evaluation of the city manager, Stephen Adams, and no new investigation ensued. From tonight's minutes in the consent agenda of August 26th, Councilmember Brown recommended an independent investigation of the July 3rd incident be placed on a future agenda, specifically stating with a public process, including discussion of the scope of the investigation and who was to be used to conduct the investigation. Council comments ensued in support of conducting an outside independent investigation that the issue of public trust and transparency is significant, said Councilmember Costello, and the process should be expedited in the issue placed agenda. No agenda item of the investigation or scope or personnel item to be placed for Mr. Adams to be placed on administrative leave. Then we come to Wednesday, October 8th at 9 a.m., a public meeting to ratify a contract and scope of work already agreed upon between the city and an investigator that was commenced the next day. The agenda was never to include the scope of work and possible investigators, as was promised on August 26th and September 20th. In fact, the mayor conducted the meeting switched around from most other meetings. The council took public comment first, and then the mayor requested the staff report from the mayor pro tem. No wonder Mr. Page burst out, "Then why are we here?" So the citizens keep coming to the mic and sharing their concerns. Where is the transparency? Where is the trust? Where is the working together to solve a problem? This city used to collaborate. When I helped craft the general plan survey, many citizens were involved.
Need to wrap up.
I will.
Wayne, please.
Well, we don't collaborate anymore, not now. Meetings are held at funny times and discussions in private instead of public. And lastly, promised items to be on the agenda are aborted. We have lost faith that the process can be authentic. So what I really want to tell you is...
Can you please wrap up?
Yes.
Thank
this
you.
Must stop. It is in your hands. Stop the collateral damage and bleeding from City Hall now. You must make this stop, the City Council. Please, you must make this stop. And the way you make it stop is to place Mr. Adams on admin leave. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Mr. Mayor, council members, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Aleji Davar. I am a resident of the city of Rio Grande. First, I commend all of you for a good job, and I thank city of Rio Grande, management, staff, and specifically Steve Adams for their good job in the city. I also thank our police department for their good job. We all know that in past several months, a single issue has dominated the entire city affair. With all due respect to City of Rio Grande Police Department, the complaint Police Association has brought to public attention, in my view, is more of an employer-employee issue. At most, it can be treated as a sort of employee grievance, not a public debate to pretty much paralyze the city government for past 3 months, We all know that, you know, Polish Association, their members at most should be 25 people. That is less than quarter of a percent point of the voting power or mature people in the city of Arroyo Grande. As I said in my previous presentation in past meeting, I urge City Council not to yield to special interest groups and stay objective and be fair in their decision-making process. It takes about 25 years of education and training to produce a good manager, and their rights should not be violated in the political smoke. And the city should not be denied of their good service. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Good evening. Kevin McCarthy, Garden Street, Arroyo Grande. A few weeks ago, I spoke briefly at the Saturday morning meeting and expressed my support for both the police department and the city council and staff. I've not changed that position, although I've been accused of not knowing the facts. I cannot know all the facts. I can't know the facts about the work that the city council does, all the different issues that are presented to you, which you then act on for the benefit of the city. I can say that when I have called the police department in the middle of the night, they're there. I put my money where my mouth is, or was. I voted for the bond issue for the police department twice. I voted for the Five Cities Fire Authority. Unfortunately, six jobs were lost because of that, because it didn't pass. I know what it's like to be in an environment that's a poor working environment as far as it affects one's morale. I am really concerned about what's happening to our community. And when I say community, I'm talking about everybody involved. And that's why I support the police department, and that's why I support all of you. We need each other. And without each other's support, we're going to devolve. I mean, it's clear. To maintain that long-term vision, I think we'll all be better off. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else?
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, council members. I was listening to the radio last night, and I heard a candidate who's running for mayor in another near town say that the mayor sets the tone of the council. And then he went on to say he does not act unilaterally. I didn't hear much else of what he said because those two statements made me pause. And I think this is exactly the source of the frustration for so many of us. For weeks, we heard the council deny, deny, deny. Ultimately, you agreed to an outside investigation, and we thank you for that. I will withhold judgment until that investigation comes back. But what really bothers me, and I just cannot get past this point, is that I believe we were knowingly and intentionally misled of the claim that there was no policy violation on the night of July the 3rd. Rather than seeing you admit to having made a mistake, with the exception of one council member, we've seen doubling down and then doubling down again. What I haven't heard, in order to convince me that there was no policy violation, not from one single council member, is that this incident does not require investigation because what took place at City Hall that night is something that happens occasionally, frequently. We know of other cities that allow this. We're not allowing anything to happen that isn't done elsewhere. I have yet to hear any council member say that their employer allows private use of their workplace. I know Mr. Costello, Mr. Brown. I'm not sure what the rest of you do for a professional living, but I haven't heard one of you say, my employer is okay with this, and at the city of Arroyo Grande, we're okay with people using a public building for private use after hours. I realize that Mr. Carmel contends that it's not in against his policy or his employment policy to have done what took place, whatever that was. My beef is two people in a public building after hours for private use. Whatever the use is, I don't care. I don't care if it's tea. I don't care if it's doesn't make any difference. But rather than claiming that he hasn't violated any policy, I would love someone to show me where it is permissible for city employees to use a public building for private use. There's a post to the Tree Guild blog where someone quotes...
Just about time, babe.
Okay, thank you. That the city of Santa Barbara has stopped using root barriers. So we're concerned about what the city cares about root barriers, but not what other cities allow.
Okay. Can you wrap it up, please?
Okay. I just think that we're setting a very poor example for those who don't know that they would ever be allowed use of the city hall for whatever reason they want to while allowing others use of that same building. Thank you
for your comments. Anyone else?
Staff, Mayor, I wasn't going to say anything, but I just here to, in support of the council and the staff, I think that this whole thing's been overblown from the beginning.
Excuse me, sir, could we get your name?
Rod Hatch, I'm sorry.
Thanks.
So I was at the first meeting back September 9th, I believe, and talked briefly. I thought the council was handling it appropriately at that time. The initial investigation seemed to clear everything up, and everything seemed to be under control, and suddenly a group of people showed up and started demanding another investigation and making accusations, which kind of floored me, frankly. I've been a resident here for 40 years now, and I've talked to a lot of people in the neighborhood, friends, and no one agrees that I've met yet with the few who are demanding the firing of Mr. Adams and a firing of the mayor. I think that I would wager that 75-90% of the people are behind you guys. I don't think there's just a handful of people are causing all the trouble. And I imagine even after this investigation is over, they're going to still come back. So I just hope that it all works out for you.
Come forward on any of the consent items. So before we bring this to the council, I'll ask if there's any member of the public who would like to come forward on any of the consent items. You're following along on the agenda. We're addressing consent items 8A through... So if there's any member of the public who would like to come forward on any of those consent items, please do.
Thank you. I would like to have you pull two items. One, the cancellation 8D, the cancellation November 11th meeting, and the other would be the approval of, I'm looking for it, sorry, my papers are in the back, of the alcohol at Farmers Market. The alcohol at Farmers Market, unfortunately, does not seem like a typical consent item. It is not routine in nature, and I believe it requires action and discussion by the council. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? Okay, seeing no one else, we will close public comment on the consent agenda. And what is the will of the council this evening? Any items to pull?
Yes, Mr. Mayor, I would like to pull 8D.
8D, David.
8D, David. 8E. 8G. And I would pull 8F as Colleen suggested and just make some, give some information on that to help clarify.
Okay. Any others?
No.
Okay. I will approve I'll entertain a motion to approve consent items 8A through 8M with the exception of 8D, E, G, and F.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. Any further discussion? Hearing none, anything to read in there this evening, Tim?
Yes, 8F, but it's been pulled.
Okay. All right, roll call, please.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right, Councilmember Barnidge, 8D, David.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I wanted to if some people in the audience or at home have not read the staff report, why we're canceling the meeting of November 11th, I wanted to pull that and just explain. There was some rumors circulating that there was some issue. We were canceling that meeting for some other reason than why we're really canceling it. Number one, it is Veterans Day, and so out of respect for veterans, we're canceling the meeting. That was in our staff report. We don't have an agenda, anything really urgent, so that was another reason to cancel that meeting. The city is closed that day, so in order to have a meeting, we'd have to have staff come here, and I don't want to make them do that on their vacation. So just to clarify why we're canceling that. So that's...
Okay, why don't you go ahead with 8E.
Okay. I move approval of 8... Oh, wait, I'm sorry, you want to do it separate all at once? You want me to do...
Okay.
Do you want me to take them one at a time?
Why don't you go ahead and take them one at a time?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would move for approval of 8D.
Okay. Very good. We have a motion to approve 8D. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, 8E.
Okay, I just wanted some clarification on this. It was a little bit confusing reading the staff report, and I think I understand it now that I talked to Steve, and we're going to use the CDBG, the funds for ADA, and a little bit, the county had approved some of the items that we had done, but then HUD came in and reviewed them and said they weren't applicable. So could you explain that, Steve?
I think Tim and I both have a little bit to add. So first, yeah, the end result is really a wash, that there was some projects for facade enhancements primarily that were determined after the fact by HUD to not be eligible. And so we are going to utilize, and so we have to pay back that money. We're using money dedicated for ADA projects to pay back that money. But then, according to HUD and the county, that money then gets put back in the pot, comes back to us the next year, which we will then use for ADA projects. So the end result is the same. We just have a year delay in terms of using that money for ADA projects. As far as where the problem occurred, traditionally those projects have been eligible. We've had a redevelopment area in the past, and so it made it easier for them to qualify those.
Feedback here. Steve, I'm really concerned about a couple things. I understand you said the HUD regulations had basically changed, but there's a whole myriad of issues where it talks of no documentation. I mean, it's throughout the whole report. And what I'm asking is, did we fall down on the job in terms of providing documentation that was needed? And if so, are we doing something to rectify that?
I could try to answer that. We use the same documentation that we've been using for the past two decades. So, honestly, we were using the same basic procedures that the county had encouraged us and over the years had essentially utilized for the same funding. And when HUD came in this round, it was looked at a little bit differently. So I don't think there was any fault on anyone's part. I think it was a fault on how the rules themselves were being applied. We rely on the county to essentially explain those regulations and tell us whether the programs we're utilizing fit within those rules.
Yeah,
and that had been done for a long time. In this instance, it was challenged by HUD on a site visit, and that's essentially what happened.
Yeah, but I think what I'm troubled by is that, it talks about lack of documentation, that things were missing, things weren't actually done in a, for all intents and purposes, regarding the bureaucracy of the process. And that wasn't new. I mean, it sounds to me like it was just a different interpretation, as you said, of the prior rules. That's not the same thing as saying you didn't have any documentation. That's a different animal altogether.
Right, I think it's the depth of the documentation that you're talking about, not that it wasn't existing, not that we didn't actually provide reports. We didn't provide reports that were satisfactory to Housing and Urban Development.
The report reads, it keeps using this phrase, no documentation, no documentation. So,
well, the quick answer to your second question is because of these changes, however they're attributed to, we are going to be reviewing and making changes and make sure that this isn't a problem in the future. It'll also be a much less problem because, as you remember, we completely have kind of revamped the block grant program. So in the future, almost all the money is going to go to ADA improvements. Part of the objective of that was to simplify the process, so that'll make it easier.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Jump in with a comment real quick here, and that is that, I mean, this has been coming on for a few years. I think that's the reason that we were changing our program to consolidate the funds into single contributions. So the county's seen this coming on for a few years, but I think one of the key things here when you're looking at the documentation is that the redevelopment agency gave us kind of a blanket coverage for blight, and that was one of the key items here. So when the redevelopment agency went away, the what I call anywhere in town or anywhere within the redevelopment agency, which was most of town, could be defined as blight. When the redevelopment agency went away, we lost that definition. On top of that, whether it's a reinterpretation or really just a much more demanding interpretation, it has been coming for a while. And this is just the final, maybe not even the final one. We may see some further review and some further revision. But this is the way it was done in the past is not going to be okay in the future. So I think that's really the – it's not just that it suddenly was somebody looked at the paperwork and it was wrong. It really is that the way it's been done historically is not going to be okay in the future.
I appreciate that clarification.
Okay, any more comments? All right.
Okay, I would move approval of item 8E.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Yes.
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 And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. You want to do G or F?
I'll go with G first. So, Matt, I was all ready to get all excited about we were saving all the water out of the big orange containers that we use to block the streets for the Halloween in the village. And then I thought, we can use vehicles for Strawberry Festival and Harvest Festival. And I was on a roll. I was thinking of all kinds of times we can use them. But you said that there's a change, and now we can't use them.
Councilmember Barnage, members of the council. So at the time that the staff report was written, there was a certain level of comfort by the...
Hang on a second, Matt. Okay. We need to get those mics up a little bit.
Yeah, the mic's on.
Is it on? Yeah, it seems low.
I'll just get closer. How about that?
Lean into it.
We had a certain level of comfort with using vehicles throughout the event, specifically the Halloween in the village. It's a pretty localized event. After the staff report was prepared and sent out, we revisited the use of vehicles specifically on East Branch, so at either end on Traffic Way and at Mason. For this event specifically, it'll be a change of using the water barricades on Branch Street and using vehicles on the side streets.
Okay, thank you for that.
I had a quick question on that, Matt. That's actually noticed that last year when we started using that when we were starting to have some of the discussions on just how bad the drought was going to get. And when you say non-potable water, where do we get that water from?
There is a non-potable water well down at the city courtyard. That's where we got some of the water for the Harvest Festival and filling those water barricades. We also had a water supplier bring non-potable water in. It's water that it's not drinkable. It's not at that level of quality, but it is, it's still, quote-unquote, fresh water.
The other thing that concerned me was when it came time to take those barricades down, and we started pulling the plug on the barricades. Is there some way, at least, that that we can connect some kind of a hose or something so that it drains down to where, at least to where they can be moved on landscape instead of in the street?
We will look into that, definitely. You know, obviously, it's a when the event is over and it's time to reopen the road, we get a lot of people who are eager to get the road back open, get traffic moving again. But again, given the drought situation right now, that might be maybe taking a little extra time to release the water, capture as much of it as we can, move those barricades into a more appropriate location, and then let them drain out.
Yeah, even if there's a way of hooking them up with some kind of a drainage implement in a tandem form. So if you have three barricades, they drain into one, and take that third one that's closest to, you know, a landscape, and at least let it percolate into the ground. It's a lot better than putting it into the street. And if we need to start that process a few minutes early and time it to when the event is over, we can, you know, maybe we can start doing that as well.
Definitely.
Any other questions on this? Okay.
Okay. I would move for approval of 8G.
Second. All right. We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Vernage?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. All right. 8F.
Okay. 8F. I'm okay with moving forward with 8F. If all the other council members are, we did. Someone can tell me the date. We did have a public hearing on this item, and was it our last meeting or two meetings ago?
Was at our last meeting.
Oh, last meeting, okay. And so it was at our last meeting, and we did discuss it, and we actually had some people here that stuck around and gave us public comment on it that evening. I think it was 3 weeks ago was our last meeting. Yes, 3 weeks ago. So I'm okay moving forward because of the public
last regular meeting.
Last regular meeting.
Yeah.
Correct.
I'd just add that we often have the second reading of an ordinance on consent agenda, so this is a typical way that we deal with this.
Okay. Anything else?
No.
All right. You want to make a motion on that?
Sure. I would move for approval of item 8F.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none. Roll call.
Mr. Mayor, that's an ordinance, so let me throw the title in there.
After Tim reads.
An ordinance of the City Council of the City of Rio Grande amending Title 9, Section 9.04020 of the Rio Grande Municipal Code regarding wine tasting at certified farmers markets.
Okay. Thank you. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Barnage?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Farrar?
Yes. All right, moving on to item 9, public hearings. We have none. Item 10, continued business. We have none. Item 11, new business. We have two new business items. 11A. Okay. 11A we'll get to in a moment as soon as we take a 10-minute necessity break. All right, so council, take a brief recess.
Could be a while.
We'll live with that. Part in this process. Mark Hutchinson with the County of San Luis Obispo helped work with all the Zone 3 agencies to develop this draft as well. And then in the audience, we will ask to assist with the presentation is Dan Heimel with WSC contractual partner that we use. Also, wanted to express gratitude to members of the agricultural community that helped us in drafting this policy as well, or the recommended draft tonight. I want to start off by just talking about some brief goals and overview of the proposal as it's drafted. The low reservoir response plan, which obviously refers to Lake Lopez, is really precipitated by the ongoing drought. This is an issue that actually there is an existing draft that's in place. However, that draft, we believe, needs to be revised and updated based on our current circumstances. That interim downstream release program was actually adopted by the County Board of Supervisors previously, and it has a low reservoir response plan. When the reservoir gets to a trigger point, which is currently 20,000 acre feet, then there's some concern about the remaining amount of water behind the dam and how will that be distributed fairly amongst all of the ratepayers and users of that water fairly and evenly. And also, it will limit extractions to preserve water for a drought of 3 to 4 years. Our planning horizon in this circumstances is 3 to 4 years. And that was that window was based on a variety of issues, and we'll discuss later on in the presentation. Obviously, we're in the middle of a drought, and the Central Coast is at the epicenter of this drought. If you can see, these were some graphs that were provided that show the severity of the drought in California, and you see it starts in San Luis Obispo County. We have been hit hard by this particular drought, and we continue to have significant concerns about our water supply in the near future. This shows the historic levels of the reservoir. We are in difficult times. We are in the midst of a significant drought. However, it's not unprecedented. We've been through some other droughts even recently. On the graph that's on the chart, there is a period of time where there was a pretty long significant drought in the late 80s through the early 90s and was followed by some El Nino years. We don't know how long this drought will last, but we do know that we need to have plans in place in the event that this drought continues. I took some photos of the lake conditions just a few days ago, and you can clearly see by driving up to the reservoir that there is a reduction in the storage up at the reservoir. It's approximately 45% of capacity at the beginning of October, and unless we get a significant amount of rain this fall, it'll continue to be a serious concern. This chart, which is also in your packet, shows what would be the projection of the reservoir level given average rainfall. We are at 22,000 foot. I'll try to get the pointer here on the screen. This is the current level of the reservoir at this point. As of October 1st, it was at 22,000 acre feet. Based on average rainfall projections, we could anticipate that the lake level will rise and stay above the 20,000 foot trigger mark if we get average rainfall. We can't predict the future, obviously, and we need to be prepared for the circumstances under which we receive less than that average rainfall. We actually put a lot of hydrologic study into this analysis, including the potential for seawater intrusion locally. So this is something that we studied from a variety of angles and took into consideration all of our water supplies, including our groundwater. That a significant amount of that hydrological study was conducted by WSC, the consulting firm that works with the Zone 3 agencies, and here tonight to talk a little bit more about the actual LLRP and the components of the LLRP is Dan Heimel with WSC, and I'd like Dan to come forward and to the podium, and he will talk about how we developed the proposal and some of the analysis that went into it.
Back the LRP, another criteria that's required is that the Board of Supervisors has declared an emergency that includes Lopez Reservoir. And currently, the Board of Supervisors has declared a countywide drought emergency, so that criteria has been would be fulfilled. Once the LRRP is enacted, there's a series of initial prescribed actions that are implemented, and these actions include reduction strategies for municipal diversions. Municipal diversions are the water that is taken from the dam, put in the Lopez Terminal Reservoir, treated in the Lopez Water Treatment Plant, and then delivered to the Zone 3 member agencies. There will also be a reduction in downstream releases. Downstream releases are the water that's released at the base of the dam into Arroyo Grande Creek. Additionally, under the LRRP, no surplus water would be generated from unreleased downstream releases as it is currently done now. And then the third sort of key element is under the LRRP, there is an extension in the amount of time that the individual agencies can take delivery of their Lopez water and thus provides them some additional flexibility to manage their water supplies. The goal of the LRRP, as Jeff described, is to make sure we have water in the reservoir for 3 to 4 years under continuing dry conditions. It's a key water resource here for the agencies, and we want to make sure that's available. To do that, it will potentially require reductions in the amount of water that can be extracted every year. And so what this table outlines, the initial prescribed reductions included in the LRRP for the municipal diversions. And on the left-hand side, we have the trigger levels that correspond to different amounts of water within the reservoir, and then on the right, the corresponding reductions in the amount of supply that would be available to the municipal agencies. We go to the next slide. These are the initial prescribed reductions for downstream releases using the same format. One thing to note here is the amount of water made available for downstream release under the LRRP is, in a sense, front-loaded. Through our conversations with ag representatives, it was determined that it would be beneficial for them to see more water earlier in the process, and then more severe or more increased reductions as the drought continues. It just fits better with their operations.
I would like to add to that the agricultural representatives were very emphatic that they have contracts in place, and once a contract is in place for them, they want to produce on that contract. And so they want to have a surety of certain water supplies for a specific period of time. So they're willing to front load that essentially essentially take the gamble that they're going to get the water through rainfall later on. And that was done, that decision was made in concert with the agricultural representatives.
So in developing these reduction strategies, it was important to have an understanding of the hydrology. Looking at the available hydrologic data, we ran several scenarios so that we could see how the reservoir would react through the implementation of this plan. So what this graph represents is, on the left-hand side, on the vertical axis is the amount of water within the reservoir, and then on the bottom axis is time. And as you see, the amount of water within the reservoir decreases as we go out in time, even with the implementation of these reduction measures. But the goal is to extend it to a 3 to 4 year period. We ran it under four different scenarios representing historical hydrologic conditions. And under certain scenarios, we can extend it to that 3 to 4 year period. However, in like the worst conditions observed, as we saw this year, in terms of the amount of inflow and precipitation into the reservoir, we may have to make alternative modifications to the initial prescribed reductions to make it beyond 2 years. And so that was one of the key components. Was built into the LRRP was this concept of adaptive management. It's impossible to predict future rainfall patterns with any certainty, and so therefore the agencies and the stakeholders needed the ability to adapt their strategy to future conditions as they are observed. And so built into the plan is this concept of adaptive management. The zone C agencies will track hydrologic conditions, lake levels, the viability of their other water supplies, and make modifications to the plan as necessary to ensure that they can maintain water with them to be retained by that agency, and thus providing an incentive for the individual agencies to conserve water during drought conditions and preserve it for potentially future dry years. Any water stored under this mechanism, however, would be subject to evaporation losses and tracked accordingly.
I would like to address one of the questions that came up with regard to that evaporation loss and the inflow. If you could address, Dan, the amount of precipitation we had in inflow this year compared to some of the years in the past.
Yeah, so unfortunately, water year 13-14, and the Lopez water year starts on April 1st and runs through March 31st, was that the driest on record for Lopez Reservoir, meaning that they had the lowest amount of inflow and precipitation into the reservoir that's been observed going back 45 years. The goal of the reservoir is to allow you to get through these dry years. That's why we store it in there. And so while withdrawals were above that, it allowed us to get through the remainder of that year. Jeff, I'm not sure I answered your question.
I think the issue really had to do with the amount of net water that came out of the reservoir after it, downstream releases, and compared to previous years, it was not the worst year on record.
Yeah, so approximately, and I don't have the numbers, but the safe yield allocated for municipal agencies, I think, is 4,530 acre feet. The downstream releases is 4,200 acre feet per year. Additionally available this year to the agencies was surplus water, which is basically was unreleased water from previous years. So this year, mostly through a significant effort by the agencies to take delivery of extra Lopez water because of concerns about their groundwater supplies, somewhere in the round of 8,000, 9,000 acre feet of water probably were withdrawn from Lopez Reservoir. There is a deficit of somewhere in the range of maybe 6,000 acre feet from what actually came in this year. However, you know, the Lopez Reservoir is operated on the concept of safe yield, so that based on the historic period of record, if the agencies take their safe yield and the downstream releases stay within their safe yield, you should be able to get through all the dry periods without the reservoir reaching the minimum pool level. And so that's I guess, back to the concept that I was trying to describe. Is the reservoir is there to allow you to have your safe yield even in years when inflow are at historically low levels. And then the last thing I'd like to cover is the LRRP adoption timeline. The LRRP, like I said, was developed through stakeholder involvement. It's been presented to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee, and it's sort of as an informational item. Now it's making the rounds to all the Zone 3 member agency governing boards to receive their input and hopefully buy-in. And then once it's gone to all the boards, it'll go back to the Zone 3 Advisory Committee for their approval. And then after that, hopefully sometime in December, it'll go to the SLO County Board of Supervisors for approval and ultimately, well, hopefully not implementation and enactment. Hopefully it gets some rain. But potential enactment later this year if we continue to see dry conditions.
Tonight, staff is bringing this item before you because, as Mr. Heimel mentioned, it will be going before the Zone 3 Advisory Board here in the near future, and we're recommending that tonight that you pass a resolution endorsing the plan. And it is an important document for us because Lopez Water Source is such a significant source of our supply. The graph on the screen shows our entitlements. 60-plus percent of our entitlements for water comes from Lake Lopez. The Santa Maria Groundwater Basin represents 35% approximately, and the Pismo Groundwater Formation approximately 4%. So obviously the Lake Lopez is a critical supply for us, and we want to extend and manage that the best that we can. The impacts on Arroyo Grande, if in fact this was implemented, in the first year of implementation at the 20,000 acre foot level, there is no reduction built into the plan. So we have a year. If in fact when we get to that trigger point and the implementation of the plan comes, there is some reduction in downstream, there's some other management practices will go in place, but we won't see a delivery reduction personally or for the city of Arroyo Grande. That would give us a year, however, to start planning and getting ready for implementation of whatever restrictions that we would have to apply to our customers. And those restrictions would come at the 10,000 and 15,000 foot triggers. Previously, we came to the council and asked you to provide some direction in terms of what our emergency water restrictions would be. And based on that direction, we will be bringing back to you in the next few months a policy that will enact historic or recommend the enactment of historic emergency water use restrictions. So that means that we would base those on the historic use of our customers for stage one of our restrictions. And then as we got to the 5,000 foot trigger, we would implement household allocations, and those are health and safety allocation totals, and that will be coming back to you in the form of our water shortage contingency plan ordinance, which I believe we'll be bringing back at the next meeting. And so that item, you will have an opportunity. The kind of rubber hits the road in Arroyo Grande, and how do we deal with a reduction in our water supply? And so this will give us a tool in order to deal with a reduction in our water supply, the water shortage contingency plan will. Finally, staff's recommendation tonight is to endorse this plan. We think it's a good, solid tool that takes into consideration preserving our water supply as long as we can in an extended drought condition, and takes into consideration all those other stakeholders such as the ag community. With that, that concludes our report, and we'll open it for any questions that the council may have.
Well, before it slips on mine, I know we're going to see more of this when that water management plan comes back to us, Jeff, but I thought we had, when we had had some preliminary discussions on reaching the 20K level in the lake, was there not some parallel policy for conservation measures that would engage at the 20,000 foot level or not?
Well, our answer that question, Steve. I know.
I thought we had kind of a parallel strategy that dealt with conservation at the 20,000 foot level, recognizing that we had a little more.
Might have been in the past. Currently, with the new approved conservation measures, we have a fully extensive program that we're going all out on, and that's not triggered to any particular water shortage. The water contingency plan is totally contingent upon the projected supply not meeting projected demand. So that's partially linked to that, but to Lopez, but it'll also be linked to what's happening in the groundwater too. So, you know, if the groundwater supply is okay, it could make up for this first stage. But if that starts to be impacted, then that's when we have to enact the overall plan.
Yeah, the water.
The emergency water contingency plan looked at our entire supply, not specifically Lopez.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Councilmember Costello?
Yeah, Jeff, one quick question. I'm doing some simple math here while you're talking this through. It seems to me that you were saying that in this last year, which was the worst one on record for the 45 years we've got a record keeping, we essentially got about 3,000 acre feet inflow. Is that a safe number to use?
I don't have the data in front of me.
Yeah, inflow for water year 13-14 was 15-19, and then rainfall, which is basically just the amount of rainfall that fell into the lake, was another 337, so 1,800.
Okay.
1850.
Okay, so I'm plugging those numbers in. I can see where we get to 4 years, and then we're at 5,000 acre feet. So even if the rainfall continues to be as minimal as it is, this. Okay, I understand the process. Thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Brown?
I think I'm just following up on what we talked about before, Jeff. I'm just not quite clear on this, on the net inflows and outflows. I think, is that basically what Joe was saying, was he had a net of three, and then the staff report, I couldn't grasp that one paragraph. That
was a little confusing in the staff report, the way that was worded. Essentially, we were trying to say that, although this is a difficult time, it's not necessarily unprecedented. We've had other years at which we've had limited rainfall and had limited amount of outfall from the lake. So not sure if I'm answering your question correctly.
I think you are, actually. The other question I had was I thought I heard when Kristen did a report on Zone 3 that we might hit the trigger like in December. Or did I misunderstand that? Because I was under the impression that you said it would be up to a year. And to me, when I say hit the trigger, it sounds to me like we'd start now. Theoretically, let's say it was really bad and we're in December now, that we would actually have to start, as the mayor talked about, that kind of a parallel track with doing some things right then and there. Am I wrong in that?
On the screen, it shows a chart that we are currently on a downward trend with lake level based on the amount of water that's being used by the customers and the amount of inflow. So if that graph continues without any rainfall, it could be projected that if we don't get significant rain in November and December, that we could conceivably hit that 20,000 trigger in December. However, written into the low reservoir release plan is that doesn't necessarily mean an immediate reduction to the Arroyo Grande citizens or water users. It simply means that the LLRP is triggered and enacted, but it won't result in a reduction of water immediately, at least for Arroyo Grande, until we hit that 15,000-foot acre level.
Okay, and then just can you help me understand the ag community's idea of front-loading it? Are they just hoping for some relief in a couple of years? Is that the main issue?
I'm sorry there's nobody here. I saw a gentleman here earlier who participated in those meetings. He's not here any longer. However, they did want to front load it. They needed a certain surety level of certain water volumes for the first 2 years, that was their recommendation. And so I don't have all of the details. Maybe, Dan, you can provide some more information on that.
Yeah, one of the other key factors was that not all the ag participants are on the same spot on the creek. And so if you cut the water in half, it doesn't mean they all get half the amount of water. It basically means the first half, the upper half, gets water, and then the guys down below don't get any water. So sort of the thought, at least my understanding for equity, was if we can just maintain higher levels initially, then everybody will have access to that water. You know, the downstream ag users would have access to that water. And then the other component is a lot of the crops that are being grown are, you know, 4 to 6 month growing seasons. And so in these later years, when it really does get dry, the potential would be that they could then fallow the fields. Obviously this is worst case scenario, but it was better to have productive growing seasons that everybody could have access to in the beginning, and then if it really got that dry, then that would be it.
And then, Jeff, my last question is more of an issue with fish and game and all the need to have downstream releases and all that regulations regarding that. Have they softened up and modified their requirements too, given the drought situation, or are they still sticking with we need X amount to go downstream?
Yeah, built into the plan are the downstream releases are those environmental releases as well. So that's actually taken into account in the strategy. And so as you can see in the later years, there's still some water until at the 4,000 foot elevation. The dam can't release any more water. That's where the inflow or the outfall pipe is. So unless it's pumped out, there aren't any additional releases. So even through those later years, there's some flow that goes downstream for environmental concerns. And for one other element that was mentioned was some of the upstream farmers have orchards, and they're concerned about the viability of their orchards in those years that are a little further out. So really both were taken into consideration. If there's no water coming into the dam and there's no capacity for us to pump water out, our understanding is that, obviously there's no capability for us to put water downstream. It would be dry anyway. So we have an artificial circumstance with our reservoir. Under many circumstances, many years, there wouldn't be any water in that creek. And so now there is. And so if there isn't any inflow, then there wouldn't be an expectation for that to be downstream
Got
either.
It. Got it. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Councilmember Varnish, questions?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Jeff, on the graph you put up, with all the years, I don't know how many years, but it showed that in 1993 the water in Lopez was similar to what it is, what we might hit or what it is now. Do you know, in looks like 1992 or 1993, were there reductions in municipal deliveries in that year?
I don't know that.
I don't know the specifics for that year, but one thing I would say is that historical operations of Lopez Reservoir are significantly different than how the reservoir is operated now. Mm-hmm. There are actually municipal diversions historically going back that far were potentially even higher than they are now. Downstream release rates were quite a bit lower, mm-hmm. But through the development of the Idris, the dam is operated under a new management rules,
right,
in a
okay.
sense.
And then the other question I have is, how often are we monitoring for the groundwater salt intrusion?
So the NCMA agencies, which is AG, Grover, Pismo, and Oceano, currently have a quarterly monitoring program where they go out and sample a whole network of monitoring wells, both for water level and for water quality. And they have done some even sort of in-between measurements, too, when concerns are...
And there was one, as I recall, that did have saltwater intrusion, correct?
In 2009, yes.
Okay, but not recently than 2009?
No, not since 2009 have they detected any water quality constituents consistent with saltwater. However, groundwater levels are at a similar level as to they were in 2009.
Okay, all right. Thank you for that. Those are all my questions.
Yeah, I think that one century well that they were looking at had, they took a couple of readings, and some of the initial readings showed a higher saline content, and then it leveled out. So I think they kept testing, and this was last year. I think it was last year. So there was some confusion, I think, about the reading.
Yeah, I guess that there are a couple shallower wells that do show elevated TDS, chloride, salt levels. However, those wells are—it's more attributed sort of to a lagoon influence, tidal influence, not necessarily indicative of a large-scale seawater intrusion event into the aquifer.
Okay, thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem, any questions?
No, mine were answered. Thank you.
Okay. All right. This is not a public hearing, but if anyone would like to come forward and speak on this issue, this would be an opportunity.
Mr. Mayor, Council, and staff, Mike McConville, 529 East Branch Street. And unfortunately, I have not reviewed the report. Shame on me. Otherwise, these questions that I have here would probably be answered. First of all, I'd like to ask whether or not the LL, is it LLRB? No.
LRRP.
RRP. Oh, I missed an R there. Anyway, number one is who first would not get water, didn't word that right, in this plan, and at what level would people start not getting water? Number two is who's the largest user now? And number three, would there be a level, and at what level would the water not be available, or the lake not be available for recreation? And has the county said anything about that? Thank you.
Okay. We'll have some follow-up staff comments and hopefully get to those, Mike. Anyone else?
I don't necessarily have any questions regarding this report. I was fortunate I did get to read it. There's a lot of things I don't necessarily understand. But I am concerned about the conservation question, Mr. Mayor, that you brought up a little bit ago. I'm a relatively new transplant from up north in the Bay Area. I did live in communities that underwent severe drought conditions prior to moving here. And I do feel that residential restrictions should kick in maybe a little bit sooner than maybe what we're talking about with regards to this plan. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? All right, we'll close with a public comment on this item. We'll bring it to the council. We'll start on my left with Councilmember Barnich.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Did we want to get Mike's questions answered first before we go to comments? Or?
Yeah, sure. Did you get those, Jeff? Can you take a shot at it?
The first two. Who won't get water out of this plan? The strategy that we will be bringing back to the council will be for stepped, measured reductions based on the amount of water that we believe we will be that will not meet our supply. So if we anticipate that we're not going to get a 10%, there will be a 10% reduction in our supply, that's the amount of water that we will ask our customers to conserve, and that'll be brought forward in a strategy that will essentially be equitable to all users, and so no one will go without water. So second was who is our largest user of water? By far, residential customers are our largest user. Who is our single largest user? I don't know that. Maybe one of the schools has probably the cemetery uses the most amount of water that we have, and we have conservation practices in place now that are helping address some of those large users. So,
well, cemeteries using a lot less water than they used to.
Correct.
And I think the third question was recreational use. At what? I don't know if we can answer that or not, but.
I can't. There was some discussion at that one of our recent meetings, and we believe that 4,000 acre foot level was put in there as part of kind of minimum pool for recreational users. So we believe that they're going to continue to be able to use that. Obviously, access will be an issue with boats and launches, but they would still be able to use the lake.
Well, looking at that, the lay of the land up there and being a boat owner, I think it's just a matter of time if we don't, if it continues to deteriorate, you won't be able to launch a boat. So circumstances will dictate, I think. All right. So okay. Why don't we go ahead with your comments?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm ready to move forward with this tonight. The draft looks fine. I reviewed it. I sit on the Zone 3 board and reviewed it there. A lot of work went into that to this. I really want to commend the TAC, the Technical Advisory Committee, because they go really in depth into these into all these issues before they bring it before the Zone 3 board. And I know Jeff sits on that, and I believe Shane does as well. And there's an immense amount of background. And so, I'm really excited that, I mean, I'm not excited because it's sort of a depressing thing to think about not having water, but I think the city is taking a real proactive approach, as are the other Zone 3 agencies, and I'm happy to see it. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Councilmember Brown?
I don't have much more to add. That was pretty eloquent. The fact that we've had all the groundwork to do this ahead of time makes it a lot easier on us, and I appreciate your explanations by both of you, and, God, I hope we don't have to do it.
Okay. Councilmember Costello.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to take a two-pronged approach on this. First, what we're looking at, the LRRP, is the plan by the county, which manages the reservoir, manages the water, as to how they'll deal with a reduction in inflow going into the lake and the reduced level of the lake. And I think I played with the numbers while we're here, and I looked at them earlier. If we continue with the same level of water going in for the next 3 years, with no further reduction than that, and we stick to the plan as the numbers are set there, at the end of about 3.5 years, we're down to that 5,000 acre foot level. That being said, I think that this is a reasonable plan to manage the outflow, which is what they're trying to do. The second part of this is going back to some of the comments that the public has made, is that we do need to continue to push and educate the community to conserve water, because we'll have a reduced level of water coming to the city when we hit the 20,000, 15,000, 10,000 acre foot levels. We have to learn how to live with that level of water. Hopefully we won't get to that extreme situation, but I think that the plan that the county's come up with for the reservoir management and the plans that we're pursuing to try to educate people and to try to get people to reduce their level of usage here, we'll make sure that we try to keep the water around for at least the 3 years. And if we get to that level, we're going to be in really serious shape. And we'll be in an extreme level of conservation, and I'm sure we'll be doing a lot of things at the city level. So all that said, I'll support going forward with this tonight and endorsing the plan.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem.
I actually will kind of jump ahead and say that I do support endorsing this plan this evening. I did want to make a couple of somewhat different comments. I think one is that we're looking at really kind of a change in thinking about how we think about safe yield, what the long-run plans are, and that's why we have what appear to be a very drastic plan coming in place. When you start showing people that you're 3 years, 4 years away from zero water coming from Lopez, that's a really significant change in the thinking that I think was in place even 15 years ago when we went through the last draft. And I think part of that is also when we have seen all the different combinations of water. There's always been the fallback that, I'm not going to say endless water, but there was significant amounts of groundwater available. The Santa Maria litigation, for all of the bad things it did, really woke us up to what the limits there are. And I think that's what we're seeing is sort of the historic culmination of those things that have been coming on for a while. I did want to refer to the, because that was one of my concerns too. I look at this and I say, you know, when we hit 20,000 acre feet, we're really just starting to think about planning. We're not actually doing anything yet. But in fact, I think this is the infamous $75,000 that we're going to spend on education is really what we're going to do. We aren't just telling people there's a drought. We're telling people what they can do to mitigate the impacts of that drought to, in fact,
mitigate the impacts to themselves in their in their own home and reduce the amount of water that they're using before we hit any mandatory limits. The last thing, I did have some concerns about the front loading, and I'm glad to hear the equity issue mentioned because now it explains it a lot better. I mean, certainly the concern is there is that, you know, you're always waiting out till the end, and then in the end say, well, you know, maybe not. But now I understand from the equity standpoint exactly how this works. So with those comments, I'm prepared to move forward and support this evening. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, first of all, thanks, Jeff, for your work on this document, and also I'm even more comfortable knowing the document that we're going to be reviewing at the next meeting and having that come along as well. You know, I think on a broader scale, while this drought has been challenging, it's also a blessing in disguise, because what it has caused all of us is to take note of the seriousness, potential seriousness, of all of this. And there's no better example of that than what we see happening at the state level, at the legislature. In fact, I cannot remember a time when the governor, and the legislature agreed almost unanimously on a water bond. And when it receives almost complete Democrat and Republican support to put in place measures that will have a long-term impact, and it will have an impact on what we do here locally, and particularly in the area of water recycling. And I really hope that we are in a position now of really creating new strategies with water recycling. And we talked about that at some of our prior meetings, and we do have a plan in place to help that along. And the more we can continue in that direction, get towards some form of a shovel-ready plan and be positioned and postured to apply for some of those bond funds, assuming that it passes. I hope it does. And then, of course, all of the strategies in place for additional storage, which I think is sorely needed. I'm not sure to what extent that can occur in San Luis Obispo County, but certainly statewide, those people who take state water, additional shortage, I think, or additional storage will help the availability of state water. So, kind of a broad spectrum. This drought has created a heightened awareness in the need to do exactly what we're doing. So, and I want to thank you personally, Jeff, for interacting so thoroughly with our America in Bloom judges. As Bob Lund indicated earlier, we were the winners of the Best Water Management Plan, and that was a national award. So that's due in large part to all of the time that you spent with our judges. So I appreciate that. So I'm ready to support this evening. We have a resolution on page 7 of the staff report. Who would like to try a motion?
Mr. Mayor, I'll move adoption of a resolution of the City Council of the City of Royal Grande endorsing the Low Reservoir Response Plan for the San Luis Obispo County Flood Control and Water Conservation District, Zone 3.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Burnett?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Farrar?
Yes. All right, moving to 11B. This is a review of the Community Tree Program, Chapter 12.16 of Title 12 of the Rio Grande Municipal Code.
Wait one moment while I get this on the screen. Mayor Farrar, members of the council, I would like to acknowledge that, one, thank you for your comments about Rio Grande and Bloom. And I do want to say that Curtis Johnson and Ron Simpson were side by side. In fact, did much of the heavy lifting with the judges. And so those guys are really the brains of the operation. Wanted to tonight introduce this topic. Previously, the council gave direction to staff to bring back the community tree program.
for some discussion and review. At that time, we indicated that we would bring back an introductory item seeking additional comment and direction from the council. So tonight we're asking the council provide direction to staff about specific areas of change to the community tree program and the city's tree regulation practices, and approve a proposed tree ordinance review schedule. I don't intend to read this, but I did put on the screen what essentially is a regulated tree. And the code is very clear on what trees are regulated and which are not. And in Rio Grande, based on our municipal code, regulated trees are located in properties in commercial, multifamily, and mixed-use zones. All trees are regulated in those zones. So any of those areas, any tree is considered a regulated tree. In addition, coastal live oak trees that are greater than 12-inch DBH, or diameter at breast height, which is about 4.5 feet off the ground, in all areas. So on a single-family residential property, the only tree that would be under the auspices of the municipal code is that oak tree over 12 inches. So a vast majority of the trees in town are not regulated. Street trees are also regulated trees, or any trees that are within the right-of-way. And so that provides kind of the framework for which the staff regulates and manages trees. In addition, and I'll just quickly go through these. I don't like to read what's on the screen, but the general health of the tree and utilities and other structures, these are authorized for tree removals, conditions. If there's permitted construction, so if there's a project where there is a permit and that permit calls for the construction of a home or a garage or whatever, where a tree is located, that constitutes authorization for a tree removal. Topography of the land, the effects in the tree removal, erosion, water retention. So there's some environmental component to our tree removal authorizations. And then the number of trees in a specific location can be removed for fire safety purposes or just general welfare services. And then good forestry practices. So there is a kind of large latitude that staff has in managing trees. It really is all about our practices and how do we implement the code that's been put in place. I want to give you some examples of how we put in practice our municipal code regarding tree removals. This is ends up being two different trees, but we did the same thing to both trees. This is a city-maintained street tree. And we go to reasonable lengths to try to preserve trees wherever we can that are street trees. And in this case, you can see where the tree has extended, or the tree had extended out the curb and gutter and was doing some substantial damage to public property. And in this case, we felt that it was warranted to preserve the tree and could do so by enlarging the tree well and by putting in a little steel plate along the gutter here that was installed to preserve this tree. So we do value street trees, do value mature street trees, so we will accommodate the preservation of that tree by doing repair. In fact, there's damage within 5 years. If that tree continues to damage within the next 5 years, that would be justification for removal. Here's another circumstance. This is over an orchard, and these are large liquid ambers, and they're frankly not the right tree for a planting in a parkway along a street and sidewalk. In this case, we replaced the sidewalk. It lifted up the sidewalk substantially. The nice, large, mature, healthy neighborhood trees. In this case, it's a city-maintained tree. The city went in, and our staff actually replaced the sidewalk in this location. So we do go to lengths to preserve trees where they are city street trees particularly. There are privately owned regulated trees. As I mentioned, any tree within a multifamily commercial mixed-use zone is a regulated tree. So we often get tree removal requests from property management firms or property owners. And in this particular case, the tree removal request was denied. This happens to be over 425 South Elm. It's an apartment complex. The large redwood tree here. Actually, it's the... I don't know that that's a redwood.
No, I think it's a... It was a pine,
it's
but
a
it...
pine of some kind. But
I can't remember which what kind. Canary Island pine.
Canary Island pine. In this particular case, it was doing... It's doing damage to the sidewalk area and to the parking lot. And in this case, the property owner agreed, and we denied this, and they did some repair of the parking lot. There was a tree right next to it, which was approved for removal because it was, this tree right down here was approved for removal because it was actually damaging the sewer system and some of the infrastructure of the apartment complex. So we do deny tree removals where mitigation can be taken by the property owner or the management company. We do, however, approve on many occasions tree removals where there is damage being caused by the tree. In this particular case, it's a podocarpus. I believe this is over at Casa Grande. You can see where the tree is right up against the building and is causing some foundation damage. This is a tree that's very large. It's only going to get larger. And in this case, it was doing substantial damage and would do more damage in the future. So it was justified for that removal. And so in that particular case, it was removed. Here's a situation in a privately owned development, Leisure Gardens, where this particular tree is a large tree for the location. It's a holly oak. It's healthy. It is not currently doing any damage. It's messy. It's over a parking lot area right here where it does drip on the vehicles, but that has not been a justification for tree removals in the past. So in this particular case, the tree removal was denied. It may not be the right tree for the right spot. If I were to be the landscaper there who designed this, I would not necessarily plant an oak tree in a small area like that. However, it's not doing any particular damage at this time, and the tree is healthy. Staff comments and recommendations. There's a substantial amount of investment of time and staff resources in tree removals and tree management. We have an employee, Pete McClure, who happens to be an arborist as well, who's significant amount of his time is dedicated to tree issues. I would say more than three quarters of his time. So we do have an aggressive tree management program, but it does take a substantial amount of our time. In fact, we recommend against any additional oversight of trees because we really are kind of at our limits in terms of the ability to manage the regulated trees at this point. If council is going to provide additional recommendations, we request that that be clear guidelines for easy application. I understand there was some challenges a number of years back on how tree removals were processed. We've come up with some pretty good practices that are generally easy to manage and easy to apply. And so we're hoping that any recommendations tonight would or that would go into the ordinance would be easy for staff to apply. I don't know if the city manager has any historic information to add to that. But I have assembled a staff tree improvement program team. That consists of our arborist, Ron, our supervisor, Kelly from planning and couple other staff, and we're looking at every component of our tree program, and including our website, the information that we have on our web, looking at our street tree list, looking at our tree planting standards, and we're looking at this comprehensively. I appreciate the council bringing this item to the forefront. It really is time for us to look at our whole program comprehensively. So we are doing that, and so we're going to make some incremental changes in-house to how we apply the program. So it's really a good opportunity to review. Recommended timeline, we are recommending tonight that the council approve as well a timeline for the review of the ordinance, and that would be would include, if approved, a tree ordinance public workshop. We would conduct this at a Park and Recreation Commission meeting, at the next Park and Recreation Commission meeting, and really invite all of the stakeholders, including property owners, including our tree trimmers, including Tree Guild and other folks who have an interest in really bring about any particular concerns and issues from the public as well. And then bring those back in the form of some recommended ordinance changes, including any recommendations that, or direction that the council has tonight. And then we would bring that back to council in January for consideration of any potential changes that would be included in through that process. Again, tonight the recommendation is that you provide staff with direction and that you approve the proposed review schedule. And with that, I want to turn it over back to the council for any questions. I do want to comment that this is probably one of the most unique trees in town. It is a landmark tree up on Sierra. Just has a really interesting structure to it, and so I included that in the slides tonight. And with that, I conclude my report.
Okay, thanks. Well, let's see if there are any questions first. I have several, but why don't we start over here with Councilmember Brown?
What I'm trying to kind of wrap my head around is that you basically said that you're trying to do best practices, and you've had the latitude to be able to do that. I mean, that was the tenor of your report, is that you have a lot of flexibility to get done what you need to do. So I'm trying to understand, if it's not broken, why are we trying to fix it? I'm not going to hold you to it, because you still haven't worked with these people that you're going to gather, but just generally, do you see some glaring problems that we have to deal with?
There are some issues with the practices that we have put in place. We feel confident with the practices we have in place. There are some concerns in terms of property owners, particularly property management firms, that feel that we don't provide flexibility enough in terms of being able to replace a tree that may not be the right tree in the right place. And I think that's probably the most common criticism that we hear. Our practice is to preserve trees, and at the cost of some public infrastructure repair, and in some cases that's difficult to explain to a property owner who may see the damage and see that as justification for removal. That's really the only criticism that I particularly had. We're responding to council requests to bring this item back, and so we provided an opportunity for some specific direction. So that's what we're doing tonight. There is some latitude in the ordinance, and I think we use that latitude. But we want to address any concerns that the council may have.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
I'll tell you what. Let me jump in here, because I was the one that kind of pushed the button on this. And the thing that is, I think, most concerning for me is the cost for remediation when we have a tree that is causing damage specifically to a sidewalk, to the public right-of-way. And And, you know, I kind of shared some pictures with Councilmember Barnidge there, you know, and I think I showed you as well, Jeff, there. I think what we're looking for here is a program that will strike maybe a better balance, if we can get there, between tree preservation and the fiscal and resource impacts of continuing to try to repair sidewalks. And I understand the five-year rule, but as I look around town, I see where we, you know, there have been sidewalk cuts, there have been tree wells that have been enlarged. In a couple of areas, there were, it was borderline whether we had enough sidewalk for ADA. And that, you know, so how big does a tree well get? And so are those kinds of things that that I think we need to be a little more mindful of. And in terms of the five-year progression, at what point do we pull the trigger if we see that, damage is continuing over, let's say, in 3 years? The other thing is it's been our practice to, when we have root intrusion under sidewalks that pushes things up, we spent quite a bit of time and effort and money going around town and milling off the sidewalks. Well, there were a couple of trees where you could see that we've essentially, and I think one of them is on Ash Street right by the entrance to the tennis courts there, where you can see we've continued to mill down that sidewalk, and now the concrete is up. You can see the dirt underneath. There's no more concrete left. So, you know, at what point do we stop milling and, retrofitting and repairing and just take the tree out? And so I guess I'm looking for maybe some kind of a process in this where we can maybe do a better upfront analysis. And I am not a tree expert, so I imagine a lot of it has to do with species and all of that. And then the other thing that I kind of wanted to throw into the scope here question was the situation that happened to me. And I know I've gotten a lot of questions about Berry Gardens in particular. And so I wanted some clarification. I don't know if the tree ordinance is a place to put it, but someplace it needs to be specified. We don't have CC&Rs. We have them in two areas, but not throughout the entire tract. So I guess a question I get from a lot of my neighbors is, you know, why are the street trees our responsibility? Those are some of the big questions that were coming back that I wanted to make sure that we address if we're going to unwrap this ordinance and see if we can't tighten it up a little bit. Anyway, questions, Councilmember Costello?
I have no questions at this time.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Jeff, did you mention, I can't remember in the staff report, I think it's worth mentioning that the city works with an outside arborist as well, Dave Reagan, if you're sort of stuck on, just trying to get another opinion of someone who is outside the city and we use him to kind of weigh in.
I did not mention it, and I don't believe I included it in my staff report. There's a circumstance under which our arborist makes a specific determination and the staff has a denial of tree removal and the applicant is intending to appeal or requests a reconsideration, we bring in an independent arborist and have that individual make a determination separate. And recently we had the independent arborist make a recommendation that was contrary to our staff recommendation, and in the end we ended up allowing the property owner to remove the trees based on this independent evaluation. And so I believe we have some safeguards in place in terms of some mechanisms for the property owner to resolve those issues that they disagree with staff on, and that is one of them.
Okay. Thank you for that, Jeff. The other question I have is on page 12 of the staff report, on item D, I'm not sure if this refers to what I'm going to bring up next, but the no tree shall be removed on any undeveloped parcel for which a tree removal permit has not been issued, or which for which a tree removal plan has not been approved. Now, we had a situation actually on Canyon Way, actually a city employee, where it was a piece of vacant land. Would that parcel fall under this, Jeff? Because I wanted to bring that up, you know, going forward to look into. I'm talking about the lot where it had many, many trees and where the developer came in and just cleared it all out.
Yeah, I am familiar with that particular site, and I'd have to read this through. But
I'm just going to make – I'll bring that up in my comments. But I thought that we didn't have a mechanism, and then I saw this, and so I wondered if it was – something that
does address undeveloped lots.
Yeah.
So yes, if in fact a property owner has an undeveloped lot and they can't come in and clear cut it prior to. So in that particular case, there were some trees removed. There were also some trees preserved. There were some oak trees on the site. But yes, that does give us that mechanism.
Okay.
So that is in here. That's a tool we have.
Okay, good. Questions? I think those are the only questions I have right now. Thank you.
No more questions. Anyone in the audience like to come forward and comment on this item?
Hi, guys. Doing? Thanks for having me. I live at 1003 Meadow Way, where Jeff just got done talking about a tree that's not doing no actual structure damage, as I can see. And I'm no expert. I plan on talking to a few experts to have them out there. My concern is, it is ruining the paint on the vehicles and the clear coat on those vehicles, and I need to know how to proceed forward to get that handled. Now, I'm not the only one in the park. The HOA has brought this to your guys' attention and to Jeff's attention, so that's why I'm here. So I need to know if we can hire a third-party independent, one that's outside of what she just mentioned, and one that's outside of what he just mentioned. Kind of where I stand.
Excuse me, Mr. Mayor. May I get your name for the record?
My name's Chris Neal. Okay. We've been operating in the local area doing propane since 1936, Delta Liquid Energy. I've met Steve and Tony over there at Malay Ford when I stuck in the gas station for him. We did some work for Cacho Asaje, and we put in a propane tank there. We're family-owned. And my concern is it's already destroyed the paint on two of my vehicles. And it's looking at about $100,000, and that came from body shops in the local area. So that tree, I honestly believe, is a tree that shouldn't have been planted there to begin with, because it's a different kind of an oak tree. So what it does is it sweats, and it puts the sap on top of your clear coat, and which just causes damage. And I understand that if you guys don't live there, you wouldn't care. But I live there, and I reside there, and there's only 5 parking spots there. So if we want to park, we have to park clear down around the corner. And then when my wife walks up at 9 o'clock at night, I believe it's a safety issue. So that's kind of where I stand.
Okay.
All right. I'd be happy to address that, and thank you. There is an appeal process. As I mentioned earlier, I happen to use as an example of one of the trees at which they're it may not be the right tree in the right place, but it doesn't, in my opinion, meet the criteria for tree removal in their tree removal program or tree ordinance. So there is an appeal process. So if the property owner disagrees with staff's opinion, there's a process to deal with that. And we've had a number of them recently where they've gone to the Park and Recreation Commission and stated their case eventually, that could make it back to the council if, in fact, the applicant continues to want to appeal. But there is a process.
Okay. All right. And we just had one of those recently that was appealed here, and we had a good discussion, and hopefully a resolution. So, okay. Any other comments?
Yeah, I have one other question.
Could you come back up to the mic, please?
My other question is that
Does that have to be through the HOA, or can that be through an independent individual that resides? I'm the first one when you pull in that parking lot on the left-hand side.
So we would deal with the property owner, so in that case it would be through the HOA. And so an individual property owner with, or an individual resident within a property that has an HOA wouldn't necessarily represent the applicant, who in this case was the HOA. Mm-hmm.
All right, okay. Thanks.
All right. Any other comments? All right, we'll close public comment on this, bring it back to the council. Let's start with Councilmember Barnidge.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Jeff.
And show him the bumper stickers I brought back, because I don't want to be the bad guy here.
Okay, I put mine in my purse. Hang on. Here, the mayor gave us all this. Isn't that lovely? I wanted to go back to this, I think the slide, Jeff, that gives staff the reasons. Oh, I have it right here on page 2 of the staff report. Tree removal requests for regulated trees are approved when one or more of the following exist. And it's property damage, correct? So in response to the gentleman that spoke about the car, I don't know specifically property damage, if that could fall under a car. Or not, but that maybe that's something to look at. I think that if we expanded it to cars, I don't want to open up a can of worms, because I'd want to see, bids or proof that there actually was, damage occurring, or the potential for damage to occur. I think that he does have a point. My dad has lots of trees in front of his house, and I don't park where those trees are because they do drop some sort of sap, but I have lots of options where else to park if he doesn't have any other options, and it's truly damaging his car. Maybe that's something we can look at. I don't want it to run rampant, and we can, anyone can use that, but if there's true damage, I think that he brings up a good point. Okay. I'm not done with my comments. That was just the So going forward with this, I wanted to find out, what's the workshop time, Jeff? Is that like at 6 o'clock at night?
6:30 is the start time for Park and Rec Commission meeting.
Okay, it is at an actual meeting. Okay.
Correct.
Okay. I think that staff does a really good job of trying to be actually quite liberal with the tree removal requests. Jeff had sent me a list of all the trees in the last year and a half that staff has approved or denied. There's actually a fair amount of tree removal requests that he approves. Lots of them are on private property that actually don't need to ask for a request. They're not regulated trees. And then there's significant property damage with some of those, and a lot of thought goes into approving or denying them. And I feel like, looking at that list, I feel like there's a lot more approvals than denials. I feel like Jeff and Ron and Pete and the whole staff, and then perhaps Dave Reagan, are quite sensitive to the fact that if a private property owner is asking to remove a tree, they're going to really consider the impact it's having on that person's property. So I think that's being done, and so I don't know. I mean, there are some issues. I think some housekeeping issues with the ordinance that we can maybe fine tune. But I do worry about creating more work for staff, because they're completely consumed by tree removal requests and tree issues. One of the things I wanted to talk about was the undeveloped parcel, and I wanted to look into that and make sure that item D fits the problem we had on Canyon Way. We had also someone on McKinley that had a full, had a lot that had oak trees covering the whole lot, and they came in with staff and they worked with planning to position their house in the middle of the lot, and they took out some trees, but they really went to a lot of trouble to save a lot of trees. So we have people like that, and then we have someone on Canyon Way that clear cuts most of the lot, and probably some of that could have been worked around for a more aesthetically pleasing site plan for the neighbors. That's who actually complained and brought it to staff's attention. I think that going forward, we can look at how the tree trimmers get the information that we have a tree ordinance and we have regulated trees. We've had a lot of tree removals on weekends that on oak trees, and they say that they didn't know. And I think if they have a business license in Arroyo Grande, they do know or they should know, or somewhere that gets missed. So I think we need to take a look at that. The development code language, there was something we put in quite a while back, or staff put in, regarding one tree every five spaces should be installed in new developments and parking lots. And that was to offset the heat island and for drainage, et cetera. Well, what's happening is developers are coming forward, and they're just dividing the number of spaces by the five trees, and they're placing enough trees in the development, but they're not necessarily sprinkling them throughout the development. So you see huge, we saw it at Cookie Crock, you see huge areas of a parking lot. I think we fixed it since then, but where the developer had the amount of trees he needed, but unfortunately they were all in one place and they weren't throughout the parking lot. So I think that that needs to be changed so that it's one tree every five spaces, actually, literally. So I think that would make for a better project, and they're putting in those trees anyway, so I don't think that's really changing much for the developer. I think the within 5 years is reasonable, that we replace a tree with a different species if it's going to cause damage within 5 years. I think staff has really worked well with certain species that are causing problems. I think that if a tree is going to cause problems in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years, I think that tree should stay, and if it's a city tree, and we should fix the infrastructure. I think there's a benefit to having those mature trees that outweighs taking it out and putting a small tree in, because it takes forever and the benefits don't add up until you have a tree that's actually quite large. And I think in Berry Gardens, the mayor's neighborhood, there are trees that are in that neighborhood that are completely inappropriate. I'm not sure, I wasn't involved in that landscape plan, but there's camphor trees, which get huge in that neighborhood, and there's ficus trees as well. And I'm not sure what we do about that. I don't know if we just go in and take all those out, or do we take a little bit out at a time, but they aren't trees that we would plant today. And so we're trying to work with this decisions that were made in the past that are bad decisions, but I don't know if the city can afford to just remove all those trees all at once, or we wait till we cause damage. So that's something to think about. And then the last thing I'll mention is that in Cherry Creek, we had an issue where the developers saved a lot of the trees over there. They went to a big effort to work around some walnut trees and some avocado trees. And what we had happened, and they, a lot of expense as well. Then what happened is a private property owner came in, bought the house, and cut down all the trees that the developer had just went to all the effort to site the house around. So I think Jeff knows that, and Jeff is maybe we're going to talk about trying to do something that will help with that, because it needs to be an easement or something, because it's not fair for the developer. Okay, I was fast and I condensed. I hope that's okay.
Okay, very good. You. Councilmember Brown, any comments?
Just a quick few. One is regarding the issue of street trees and the damage they do. I want to make the observation that towns that have mature trees versus younger trees make a huge difference. I've been in communities where they have mature street trees and those that don't, and it's a huge difference. And I get nervous that if we take out some of these mature trees, it's going to change the, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but the sense of the neighborhood. And so I do think that those trees, especially mature trees, are worth the time and energy and effort, because it all adds to the overall quality of our life. I do understand the shaving of the sidewalk issue. I totally get that. But just generally speaking, I would say we really, and it comes down to common sense, and I think Jeff and his staff have done that, and I think they have plenty of latitude at this point to do that. I get very nervous about opening up the ordinance over things like health issues, because I think people have personal responsibility regarding health issues, and so that if that comes back as part of the ordinance, I'm gonna fight against that. In terms of the damage issue, that's a more vexing question, and I don't have an answer right now. But again, we have to have some sort of definition, otherwise everybody could come in and claim that same thing. And the mayor said at last meeting, and he said at this meeting, there's trees that aren't planted in places they shouldn't be. And I'm not quite sure how we deal with that, whether we just start over or whether we deal with the consequences of what was done years ago. I don't have an answer yet. But I clearly think that oak trees or street trees or anything that adds to the ambiance of Arroyo Grande and what Arroyo Grande is worth the time and energy to and a heartache, quite honestly. I understand it takes effort. Please believe me, I understand the energy you guys put in. I think that's part and parcel of, if we really are a tree city, that's part and parcel of what we do. So those are my comments.
Okay, thank you. Councilmember Costello.
I think we have a fairly good system in place. It needs to be tuned up a bit. My comments are going to be similar to what some of the things you heard. Yes, we want to have mature trees, but no, we don't want to have trees that are inappropriate in the wrong space. So I think we need to give guidance to, and we need to come up with some guidelines that will allow trees that are truly damaging to an area to be dealt with. You go to a three-year, if we have a tree that's going to create damage within 3 years, I don't think that's an improvement over the five-year, because a five-year period of time, something that doesn't damage in 3 years will damage in five and may be dealt with. So that actually is going to affect more trees than just the three-year. So I think keeping the five-year time period is appropriate. I think we need to give a little bit more latitude, a little bit more guidance in terms of the economic impacts that go into decisions about tree removal. As the gentleman says, he's got $100,000 worth of damage to several vehicles. I think if someone can prove the economic need, we need to structure the guidelines that take that into consideration. And I'll go back to the medical issue, too. If someone can bring in certified proof from their medical provider that there is a health issue from a specific tree, I think that may be something that we need to have latitude for you to deal with also. So all in all, I think we need to just provide a little bit more guidance, and this is going to come through the process that you're talking about with setting up the workshops to get a little bit more input. But I think the system is not broken as such, but just needs some revisions. And that's where my decisions would be, really looking at documenting the economic factors and medical factors and giving you a little bit more flexibility to deal with that. Now, we may want to tie in some sort of provisions that say if you're going to remove a tree and it's because of economic reasons, because it's an inappropriate tree, that a tree of a certain size has to be brought in. You don't just put in a five-gallon can. So that mitigation side of it may be something we want to include in the process, too.
All right. Mayor Pro Tem.
Most of it's already been dealt with, but I do want to. I'll also echo the consideration of the economic impacts, you know, both to the property owner and also even to development. I think sometimes we err on if you're a developer, we really treat you significantly different than we would an existing property owner. The other economic issue that I'd like to see staff review would be how much staff time are we really talking about? I mean, you know, is this $100,000 a year, or is it $20,000 a year, that we have some sense of what it's costing us? I would agree that clearly being a tree city is a huge economic you know, for all of the property owners in general, but I do think we do need to take a look at what it really is costing the city, especially because we need to look at long-term sustainability. I also would like to hear, I hear the five-year rule. How do you, I kind of like to hear when you come back, how you, what process you use to establish that you think you'll be remaking this repair in 5 years. I know it's based probably just based on several people's experience and going, oh, we did this to this tree X many years ago, and so we can expect this in the future. But I think when we bring this back, I kind of like to hear a little harder. You look like you're going to answer my question right now, but a little harder estimate about how we arrive at that decision.
This issue's come up a couple times. I just want to make sure we're clear. In terms of the 5 years, the determination on the tree removal has to do with when the repairs were done previously. Oh. So it's not what we're expecting in 5 years. It's what's happened within the past 5 years. So within the past 5 years, if you have replaced a sidewalk, replaced a driveway, replaced whatever, then that constitutes a justification for the tree removal instead of a repair. So that's how we've interpreted that. Okay. And that's the practice. It doesn't say that specifically in the ordinance, but that's the practice that we've used.
Okay. I appreciate that explanation, because then I'll flip it around and say then perhaps we want to be using our experience now that we have and be looking at it as even that first repair worthwhile, and particularly the example the mayor gave where it's obvious that you're going to do two of these or three of these, and then you're going to be doing some more significant repair, or is it even repairable? Are we just extending a three or five year situation before we have to make the hard decision? And so I kind of like to hear how we might look at that. Also, you'd mentioned the trees that have been that we've allowed to be removed. I'd kind of like to see that number of how many trees that were in fact approved that were in fact covered by the ordinance. That, you know, not just every tree that ever, and you say, well, that's not covered. I'd like to hear how many of them have we approved for removal that were covered trees, and how many were not. I think that'll give us a sense of where this is. And then I just want to make a general comment about the tree ordinance. I mean, it's probably 10 years old now. I'm not sure how long ago we adopted it, and I think it's really appropriate that over time we've seen it evolve the way that we deal with this. I think in the beginning we probably saved every single tree. They're just you could barely pull a weed out of your yard at one time. But I think over time we have seen, and I'll touch on a potentially touchy subject here, and that is eucalyptus trees at the police station is a classic one that probably we've looked at two or three or four times, and ultimately, I know a lot of people think this is just because it was a city tree or because it was a city project, which is a touchy part of this, but I also think that it was an evolution of really looking at what the trees really provided us versus what I'll call the quality of the overall environment. Now that they're gone, frankly, I miss them. But you know, that I'm driving down the street and I come down Halcyon all the time there. But I have always supported removing them. But on top of that, I think that was kind of the evolution of, okay, so let's go with two trees. Okay, let's look at a way to work it. And ultimately, there were better alternatives than keeping those trees. And I think in the beginning it was a very difficult decision. I think our process has evolved to the point where lenient is probably the wrong word, but we're much more open to what possibilities are out there. I'll also just comment on the way that our process works. We don't see a lot of trees appealed all the way to the city council, two or three, which probably tells me that people may not be totally happy with the process, but as a rule, we're able to work this out. Otherwise, I think we would see hundreds of trees appealed, and I think that's a testament to the way staff has worked with this, and also to the reality of what the requests are and how important they are to the applicant. Is it worth the appeal? And once they get to council, they are going to get a fair hearing, and as a rule, I think we're probably 50-50 on removing trees. So, yeah, I'm certainly in favor of seeing it come back. I'd like to see some more specific metrics, I guess is what I'm saying. But I just generally feel that if you look at the real practice of this, unless we're investing huge amounts of money in saving trees or huge amounts of money in reviewing trees, that I think our process probably works pretty well here.
Okay. Well, appreciate all the comments. I think the one that I keyed in most was your comment, Councilmember Barnidge, with regard to the fact that, you know, our public works folks, our crews are somewhat consumed by tree issues. And I guess I'm looking for that balance that will keep that from happening. And so it's, you know, it's the frequency, it's both the frequency and the intensity of the sidewalk repairs. And, you know, I, in my little kind of personal survey around town, I mean, I saw, in fact, there was one in Berry Gardens, I saw a fairly young tree, and the trees in Berry Gardens are less than, you know, around 10 years old, some less than 10 years old. And they're already causing problems, and one in particular, you could see a recent sidewalk cut, and the tree root was already starting to push it up, and it was marked again. Somebody went by and marked it again for another cut, and the original cut hadn't even faded. I mean, it looked like it had been done a couple of days earlier, and you could see the movement of the sidewalk. So I guess what I'm looking at is... you know, if we are focusing on the five-year thing, I'd really like to see something happen so that we can detect whether there starts to be some sort of progressive damage during that five-year window. And I know that's, you know, that in itself may be staff intensive, but when you continue to look at tree well cuts and the costs associated with that, when you continue to look at... particularly the curb repairs and what we've had to do in some of those locations, cost and labor intensive. So I guess what I'm saying is that it would be nice if we had a relook at that balance. On the issue of Berry Gardens, I it's not just because I live there. I am speaking because I get so many questions from the neighbors on that. And that is the whole street tree responsibility issue, Jeff, and you and I have had this conversation. I think a lot of us are confused because there are no CCNRs in there with the exception of the townhomes. And the only reason why they have their own little HOA is because they have a common area, and one of them has the drainage basin. But the trees themselves, in the large part of the tract, are not under CCNRs. So I'd just like some clarification on that. And, you know, you don't have to do it tonight, but at some point, if we could take another look at that. We've had so many problems with those young trees in our tract, and if you look from street to street, you will see more mature trees like on our street on Blackberry, but if you go a couple of streets over, you will see where there are some of those trees I know have been replaced and taken out because, you know, they were, and probably by the homeowner. It's either that or soil configuration or species. They're not growing as fast, whatever the case may be, but you see irregular growth all through that tract, and I'm not sure why. You know, you're well aware, full disclosure, the Friday before the Harvest Festival, if you recall, it was very, very windy that day, and I had a very large street tree, had lost its leaves, and was not looking healthy at all. It was bowed, and I came home from out of town, and it had snapped off below the root ball, and was in the public right-of-way, laying across the sidewalk and blocking probably, 15 feet of the sidewalk. There was no way anyone could pass through that area. They had to walk in the street or way up on my lawn in order to get around. So it was late Friday, I didn't know what to do, so I called Jeff, who was getting ready for the Harvest Festival, but the guys came out and took it off the sidewalk, and there was no way I could do it myself, and wound up hauling it to the courtyard, which I thought was a nice gesture until I got the bill from Public Works, which I paid. So, but still, there's a lot of confusion about, you know, what happens if something like that falls in the public right away. What happens if, you know, are those trees actually, you know, partially the responsibility of the city? I don't know. But if we could take another look and get some clarification there, that would be good. Now, the last thing, I am very sensitive to the issue of the trees that sweat or bleed, particularly the oaks. And if you look at, you know, even an area where there's an HOA, you usually have limited parking in some of those developments. And if you have a tree or a group of trees that is essentially causing that kind of a disruption in terms of what it drops or sweats, nobody can park there. You cut down on the parking places, and we all know the controversy we've had year after year about parking availability. But I, you know, I parked my back then newer Honda Pilot under one of those trees and made the mistake of, and I saw it. I saw the dripping. It was only one, but I left it there instead of trying to remove it right away. And the next day, I finally got it off, but not until I went all the way through the clear coat. So, there, you know, there is potential there for some real damage. If we're going to revisit that, I would just assume we see what we can do to take it out of the appeal process and maybe have you guys take a look at it earlier through maybe some additional criteria, embellished criteria that would allow for a closer look at those kinds of situations so that, you know, maybe we can do something about that earlier. You know, that was my purpose for bringing it back. I appreciate the comments that the council has made, and Jeff has been very open to looking at ways in which we can, you know, move forward and have, you know, more effective policies and procedures in place. So I appreciate it. And so I will entertain a motion here.
Do we need a motion? I think we're just providing guidance to staff.
Do you want us to kind of summarize what I heard, and then we can, Jeff and Tim can add in?
Well, we do have to approve the proposed tree ordinance review schedule. That was the motion I was looking for.
Okay. We'll do that first, and then we wanted to get clarification on specific items.
Okay.
That you want to just come back to.
So do I have a motion for the second action here?
Moved.
Second.
All right, we have a motion and a second. Discussion? Hearing none, roll call.
Councilmember Costello?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Guthrie?
Yes.
And Mayor Ferrara?
Yes. Okay, so do we have kind of a shopping list there, Jeff?
I do. I wrote some notes down as we were going. I believe the city manager had some comments as well.
Economic impacts. Currently, we've been pretty drawn a pretty clear line that if a tree impacts a structure, that it qualifies it for removal. If it's just a parking lot, pavement, or something, it usually doesn't. So it looked like you wanted us to come back with more criteria that involve the actual dollar amount of the impact of a particular damage of a tree. Re-looking at the balance of when the trees are removed as far as whether that 5 year is the right period or if there's something else that should be adjusted there. Trees that cause damage from droppings, either the leaves or sweat, or some kind of criteria that would look at that. The one question I had that was probably, I thought, the biggest issue, and I'm not sure we got direction on it, and that was that currently we do not use the species of the tree as a criteria for removal. If it's a mature tree, It doesn't matter what kind of tree it is. That's not a criteria. And so I know there had been some discussion, but I didn't hear really any direction on that. Is that something you want us to look at or not look at as far as criteria?
Well, I, for one, would like to see it there because, again, on a personal note, my trees are literally ganging up on me. And, you know, it's not just the one that fell over on the sidewalk. It's, you know, it's the other one that I pointed out to you, Jeff. I was on another business trip, came home, and I think it was one of the trees, the camphor tree. Mm-hmm. You can see my parkway, and we're talking less than 10 years old. My parkway has elevated because it's root-bound underneath and snapped off one of my sprinkler heads, and water was shooting up in the air. And if it hadn't been for a contractor working right across the street who shut the water off and repaired it for me and cut roots around it so that, you know, so that it wouldn't happen again, you know, I would have had the water police out there, which would have made things really bad. So, I would like some attention or at least some revisiting of that criteria. And
as we go through the hearings and stuff, we can come up with some options. Right now, we're just looking for what direction on items you want us to look at.
Especially if it's a younger tree that we know is going to continue to cause damage. So,
can I comment? Yep. So I would agree that as a street tree where there's limited space, there's certain, you know, camphor, ficus, liquid ambers that we know those aren't trees that are fun to have around limited infrastructure. But I wouldn't want to limit those trees in areas that are bigger, parks or islands that are sometimes 15 feet by 15 feet in other developments. So definitely for street trees, they aren't on our street tree list anymore, so that helps. But if we want to make note of those offensive species as in tree wells or limited spaces, I think that's prudent. I don't want to get rid of those in all landscaped areas.
Well, we can come back with some options.
I had all the same comments there. I did have a couple specific requests. One was from Councilman Guthrie regarding the cost for our tree activities and bring that information back, as well as the quantities of tree removals, just to got to get a perspective. Also, there was a request for some consideration of the development code related to parking lot trees and the binding of conditions on the developer onto the single-family residential property owner was another item that I heard from the council to address. And those were the items that I garnered from your discussion.
Do we have any mechanism for tree trimmers to be, so we actually know they have our ordinance and have the rules as far as the oak trees and such, Jeff?
There isn't a mechanism. That's just really one of those proactive things that staff needs to do. Actually, we feel pretty good about most of the local tree trimmers. There is a company that came out of Santa Maria recently that took a tree down without a permit, but for the most part, they're all pretty well dialed in. I did plan to send out a mailer, just a reminder to them as well.
So. Okay, thank you for that, Jeff.
Okay. Don't see anything else. You got enough? All right. All right, that will take us to item number 12, council communication. Any...
I have a quick one.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm not going to be here for the next meeting. I have a mandatory meeting. I have to be at San Francisco. I can't get out of it. I'd love to get out of it, but I can't, so I won't be at the next meeting.
Okay. And I'd like to apologize to the council for missing last week's meeting. I was out of town the entire week and couldn't get here, so I do apologize. I try to manage my work schedule to schedule the times I'm going to be out of town for weeks that I know there's not going to be a council meeting, and unfortunately, with a special session coming in, I wasn't able to be here. I do apologize.
Okay. Any other council communication? All right. Staff communication? Any staff communication?
No, sir.
All right. That takes us to our final community comments and suggestions. Anyone who would like to, and we're also going to have comments on closed session as well. Mr. Keene.
John Keene, 298 North Elm Street. In the discussion of the tree things, I happened to be on the Planning Commission when Berry Gardens was approved. And one of the two main things that I look at now that we required was the parkway and the street trees and making sure that garages didn't face the street, garage doors. And I think when I drive through there now, that two things enhance that neighborhood more than anything else. So what I don't want to see is us to get into changing the codes, the development codes, where we can't have parkways. I know they're hard to water and all that, but I think they really enhance a neighborhood. And I don't just to get away from the street trees, I don't want to see that taken out of the development code. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments? All right, we'll close the community comments and suggestions. And before we go to closed session, we do allow public to come forward and comment on closed session. When we do go into closed session, I don't anticipate looking at the two items on closed session that we will reconvene and give a report here. We will give the report at the next regularly scheduled council meeting. So anyone who would like to come forward and comment on the closed session items?
Man, you keep it cold in here. Tonight on the closed session is public employee pursuant to government code section 54957, title city manager. And I didn't get to finish my comments earlier, so I'd like to go through those. First off, in relation to that evaluation, your employees are suffering, and I've contacted many of you. Beyond the employee assistance program, I think it's at the point where you need to be offering some confidential counseling on their workday. They're tiptoeing around. They're feeling that there might be retribution or retaliation if they're interviewed or give honest feedback. So I'm really hoping that someone's going to be offering some counseling, some exit interviews when they start leaving, and tracking the fallout from the council's failure to act. Beyond that, the question, and I've asked the same one every time I've come to this podium, and that is, does the council still stand by your decision to not put city manager Steve Adams on leave? Every year at the school district, we put four or five people on leave for various reasons. We have maybe an outside person investigate it. Sometimes it's our HR director. Sometimes they come back to work. Sometimes they don't. That's how it's done. And I'm really disappointed that we didn't just follow standard HR policy to do that. Your failure to act and treat all your employees equally is downright unbelievable. It is time to admit a mistake has been made. Thank you, Mr. Brown. And make the needed corrections and apologize. This should have been so easy, you guys, if it was just done with right away. And what I said earlier, it must stop. The collateral damage and bleeding from City Hall is too much. And really, the power is with you to put an end to this. You can make amends with both the police and the citizenry, and the sooner you do this, the better, because this has to come to an end. So I'm just going to leave you with one quote as you go into your closed session. And the quote's from Mr. Otis Page. Because I can't figure out the answer. Why did Adams slap the police about it, and then why did Ferrara expend his considerable political capital and reputation to cover it up? These are the two net most significant issues, and not the probable dalliances in City Hall after a celebratory evening of dinner, wine, and tea. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Anyone else? All right, we'll close public comment on closed session, and council will adjourn to closed session at this time.